Good morning and welcome to the September 10th, 2025 work session for Island County. And we're starting with Public Works. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Commissioners. Ed Sewester, County Engineer, here with the subject of the multi-year consultant agreements. We're on a three-year cycle, and our current three-year cycle ends at the end of 2025. So we've prepared for the 2026 to 2028 sessions, essentially. The agreements, they're a standard WashDOT professional agreement that we use. So they write the contract and we just use their templates and fill in the names and the services that we request. I did put a piece of paper in front of all you because the system that we have, which works really good, the IT system caught one of the applications and put it into spam. So it never got through to the person that we received all the applications. And it's the actual new number 27 on the list. The original listing only had 26. So IT went back and they found it. It was submitted timely. And we actually use this consultant. So I would like to add that that name to this listing here as well with the listing. What happened when we put out the original request for proposals? We received input for all categories except for three, cultural resources and archaeology that we have to use on all of our ARC sites, material sampling and testing, good for pavement, and the traffic signal maintenance, which we have seven traffic signals that we need to continue to maintain. So we did not receive any applications for those three. So I'm going to have to come back to the board because we're going to put out a separate request for proposals, pinging the system again and making some calls to get applications in for those. But these are the consultants that the team reviewed the applications, did interviews on, and proposing that if approved to go out with the standard templated contract and then bring them into a consent for authorization for the contracts.
Any questions?
What of these contracts, were there any increases in any of these key contracts?
There's no increases in the amounts of any of these.
Any questions?
So this is the amount that you can use under this contractor without going out for a separate bid. So you're not necessarily spending all this, you're
right,
allowed up to that amount.
Correct.
And then for the three categories that we don't have consultants for, you can go out individually project by project to solicit consultants for that, can't you?
Well, we can do that, yes. Yeah.
So
yes.
If we don't get anybody who wants to just be under the contract, we can still find contracts.
Oh, yes, we can.
Contractors.
Yes. Yeah. We just go through that individual effort
right.
each time.
Okay. And then do these have to be approved by the state, or these are just locally approved contractors?
These are locally approved.
Okay.
They run through the state. They do get audited for their overhead rates, for their hourly amounts,
yeah.
And we get the paperwork back from WashDOT.
Okay, so the three categories we're still looking for somebody for. It's not that they're not on a state list. It's that nobody responded.
Correct. And the consultants that we did talk to after the fact, well, we didn't see the posting,
yeah.
So they weren't watching it, but
okay.
Now we'll make sure it gets advertised a little different.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. May I ask a follow-up question? Sure. On the projects that weren't bid on, if they're small enough, you can pull those off the small works roster?
We can go through MRC, yes, we can do that. Okay. We have to write it is a longer process to do that, to write the scope and prepare the documentation. But yes, we can go through that route as well.
That's questions my assumptions. My assumption would have been it would be more streamlined. So that's good information.
Anything else?
Mm-hmm.
Okay with the consent?
Yep.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, here's 27. Steven.
He gave just preaching.
Good clarification on the up to thing, Commissioner.
Okay, good. And now we're moving to public health. Good morning, Sean. Good
morning, Commissioners. Sean Morris, Public Health Director. Two items today. The first is a contract renewal with Puget Sound Partnership for our Island Local Integrating Organization, or ILIO. The difference being this provides the funding for 3 consecutive years, so we will not need to revisit the annual contract for 3 years with PSP. Beginning October 1st, 2025, this funding runs on the federal contracting year, so October to September. This provides all the funding for staffing for our ILIO natural resources work. Jen Schmitz, natural resources manager, is unable to attend today because she's in an LIO meeting, but she can follow up with the executive team or the board on specific tasks. So as you know, but for the public, the LIO supports watershed planning and restoration coordination for all of Water Resources Inventory Area 6, or WIRA 6, which is Island County, and helps coordinate among committees and watershed groups for collective actions and restoration for implementing watershed-focused programs and projects in our communities. The work is coordinated with Salmon Resources, Recovery Council, a number of other entities and organizations coordinating the executive committees and the technical advisory committees, the annual Ecosystem Coordination Board meetings and other ECB meetings as the Whidbey Basin representative, and a number of other activities. There's an annual action plan that is developed that outlines tasks that is brought to the executive committee. And again, Jen can bring those specific actions and tasks in further detail if that's of interest to the board. But overall, the request is to move this contract forward to consent, or I can address questions.
I'm
fine.
Okay. So this says this contract will be utilized to fund the ILIO coordinator position within DNR. We have a separate ILIO coordinator position.
It's actually Jen's position is
so
the DNR manager.
Fund the DNR manager position.
That's right. Yeah, she performs the related functions.
Okay.
Yes, I said I didn't have questions, but I came up.
Sure.
Is the remaining capacity that's not used for salaries used for project work, or this is all salaries for Jen and then support staff?
There's some support staff salary and benefits, and then the related costs for meeting coordination. There are costs for that. As far as project costs directly,
that comes from a grant, different grant.
Yes.
Okay. So this contract is for staffing, not for project work.
There are no tasks, deliverables that relate to direct project beyond developing the action plans and all the reporting and all of those associated requirements.
Okay.
Jen can correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah.
You had a very tight budget, because there's cuts and things happening. You were trying to squeeze every penny you could out of every line. Was this included in the budget that you submitted?
It was, and it's great news because we know, you know, this funding comes through the EPA, the national, I believe through the National Estuary Program is the parent funding. So having 3 years of funding we can rely on is really great news. It actually ups the amount just slightly to around $150,000 per year for the 3 years. So it's great news for the team for our budget.
Great.
All right. Anything else?
We'll take it.
We'll take it.
Thank you. The second item is to bring back a process, but to seek board input on a process involving coordination across departments. And if it's okay to invite up representatives from planning and public works, if you'd like to. So in the past, the permitting departments were meeting regarding cases that were escalating within each team. You know, we're always communicating and working across departments as these cases escalate because they often touch on our different sections of code. And we work to take aligned actions. And we have a number of cases, all of us, you know, so we're always triaging, putting attention towards, you know, those, when we think about escalating action, you know, it's the most kind of problematic cases through that lens of public health and public safety, where there's the most community impact. Often you're hearing about these cases at regular session. And so the goal is to thinking about our limited resources within departments to take on cases. How can we better coordinate across planning, public works, public health, human services is often involved, through co-response or concert sending referrals over, because there are often co-occurring mental and behavioral health issues involved or substance use disorder. And so with this team, the goal is to meet quarterly with representatives from public health, planning, public works, the prosecuting attorney's office, the sheriff's office, and human services to take an overall review of the cases that are rising to the top for each of our departments, talk about shared evidence in which cases we should be briefing the board on. So the first ask is if this approach is supported by the board and what any direction from the board on that.
So I was looking, and may I? Mm-hmm. I was looking for what we were consenting to. What sure. You're asking for is direction, correct? We're not trying to move anything to consent.
That's okay. Correct.
All right. That was just a clarification because my brain was in a different groove and I was looking for what you were asking for consent on.
Right.
So thank you. And yes, I'm supportive of the joint response approach.
Okay. Any thoughts?
No, I set some of these meetings up years ago and they kind of fell apart, I think, so because, COVID and the things. Yeah. But I don't think there's a way to solve many of these problems without a kind of a shared team approach. Also on the staff side, it saves some resources if you're coordinating.
Right.
So that's important also.
Thank you.
So I like it, but I mean... And then you would determine as a group which ones you'd bring forward to us for consideration for next steps. Is that kind of where we're at?
Yeah, both for awareness, because not all of these are in the place of next steps yet. And mm-hmm. So more for, to provide that information to the board. And then if the board would consider any of these for further action. To add.
No, I don't think so. I think that... The team has been working really well together and bringing those forward. There are a few items on this list of ones that we're having existing cases on, but I think this is a good collaboration between the departments and it really just moves those cases along.
Can we, I don't know if this is what you wanted to do right now. It's what I want to do.
Sure.
I thought we'd spend some time. We didn't spend any time on this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So I kind of wanted to talk through like this one. I understand public health, but I'm a little confused about, so this is inside the city limits. Mm-hmm. My understanding, and maybe I'm wrong about our own interlocal code, but my understanding is when some infrastructure fails within the city limits that they have to hook up to the sewer system of the city. So is that not a code requirement anywhere? I mean, is that not in our interlocal with the city of Oak Harbor?
For this one, I'll invite Heather up, who knows our mobile home park code a bit better. So this was one where we had a mobile home park failure. We're just providing road names to provide a level of privacy to community members. And Heather, if you could share a bit about our approach to this.
This one's not in city limits. This is across from the one that has...
Yeah, I know where we are. Okay, sorry.
But we do have a pending permit on this one now.
It's moving. Forward.
So it is moving forward, but it wasn't when we started this process, it was in a really bad state that was dangerous. So we posted it immediately because there was life hazard on the parcel. There was a septic tank that the entire lid had fallen in. So not the little green things, the entire concrete lid. So that's a 5x9 hole in the ground. Luckily, there's a shed over part of it, but there was enough exposed that a very large human could easily fall in.
Not to mention a curious kid.
And exactly. Was the reason we made them fence off. And so that one was a little bit outside of.
But here where it talks about fencing off dangerous elements, they don't have to get a permit to do that, do they?
No.
It's really just caution taping. you know, making sure that
our secondary is more okay. unable to go over. We made them be more because we had the one that was definitely life safety, but then we didn't make them put up like a chain link. They've got a temp fence, but it isn't like a bigger, it's not just flagging anymore because we had the entire drain field, which would probably go from Jonathan past Layla, was a lake once it got mowed because they just haven't taken care of it. And so it was just back there flooding the raspberries and no one knew. So there was multiple places for contact. So that's why we had the fencing. We don't usually have to go to this extreme. It was just there's children there and we need to protect.
No, go to those extremes.
Fencing's not an extreme. I just wanted to make sure that they didn't have to get
those aren't permit. Extreme. Well, I mean, we don't usually stop the order immediately, but we had to on this one. So
I appreciate the proactive.
So this one's getting solved.
Mm-hmm. It's moving forward.
It's probably going to end up with a state loss. So it's going to take a little longer, but they have contractors on it and they have pumping happening to keep things and they have the fence in.
And when you say it has a state loss that it has to have, then it has to go through that robust state permitting process. It can't go through our local one.
So they're looking at, they're working with an engineer. And if the engineer and the owner, I mean, it's really their choice.
Yeah.
If whether they want to do two separate systems that the county can approve or one larger system. And so that's kind of where they're at. And I think they're leaning towards the larger system. But that's the last update I had. So.
And in what we're asking for in our legislative changes, would this be one of those types of examples where it could come in more affordably if they change the limit on how many gallons you could?
Yeah, if the
I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, even if they just at the state, if they implemented a tiered
program
once we're over 35, that's one of the things we're asking for because it would make these smaller systems able to have really that more robust treatment system that they can get through a loss, but less onerous because, you know, the same rules apply from 3,600 gallons to 100,000 and that doesn't make sense. So that's what we're asking for.
So on this one, this unrelated but related, could you send us a kind of a case study on the cost differences between what it would be if they go through the state process and what it would be timeline wise as well as cost wise if we were able to do this locally? Mm-hmm. Because this is also an affordable housing related issue. Mm-hmm. And so the excess costs get passed on to these renters or homeowners, depending mm-hmm. on the case. I think this is a good illustration of why we need those tiers.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll work on that for you.
Thank you.
Some existing.
We have a few, programs. Yeah.
Okay.
So this next one, this one also involves sewage septic failure and gray water discharge. There's Valeria's involvement and solid waste accumulation, and we have issued notices of violation for this one.
Mm-hmm. This is one we posted yesterday.
Okay, so yesterday we did post a health officer order because we just have not been.
Okay, so there's a health officer order now.
But you noted here it's in probate. So is that why no one's responsive? Is because it is in probate, or you don't know?
Or Mike actually has a little bit more
information. Which one were we on?
Number three.
Country Lane.
Yeah.
Last we talked to the owners, Eric spoke to the
sister.
The sister. Mm-hmm. They're working with Waller and Waller to evict anybody that's on that property.
Yeah.
And it is in probate right now.
The sister and her daughter live in the house with the failed system that's overflowing. So so we actually need them to do both, but they are at least going after the RV issue right now. But it's all, unfortunately, it's all uphill of a huge wetland that is a pretty critical wetland for that area, so
it is.
So we'll keep you updated as far as the progress with the health officer order.
The multiple RVs that are on the parcel and are direct discharging into the nearby wetland, how many is multiple?
Six right now.
Six.
We've been as high as nine. We go in and do visits and discuss things. And then the next weekend, there's three more. And then they're in and out. And so, and they're not, the lady in the house, whose sister passed, whose estate it is, who's trying to deal with everything, these folks will not. That's why she's had to engage a lawyer. So they're trying to do this, but this
other doesn't have a relationship with those people who have art.
No,
on
apparently
property.
Her deceased sister did.
So my money on this one. There's not a mechanism where someone can evict somebody, just say, get off my property and call them in as trespassers, and law enforcement says you're not allowed to live on somebody's property.
Mm-hmm. And county code says you can't have an RV
property. So the reason I'm asking is because this is actually a significant conversation, more significant than maybe even this. When we're talking about allowing RVs on private property, there has to be a mechanism in place for those homeowners to get them off. If there is not a mechanism in place for those homeowners to get them off, that's going to be problematic about allowing them to go on those properties.
Right.
Because otherwise, how? So I guess I was just under the assumption that if you're on my property and I say you're not living here anymore, that I could call law enforcement and have them evicted off my property.
It's a little more complicated than that.
Apparently.
Like, you offer somebody, you know, hey, come live on my property. They establish residency there. That becomes their home. And then you can't just change your mind without going through the process. So, like, it's part of the Landlord-Tenant Act, like a renter situation as well. Goes through the same process where a landlord would have to formally evict that person who's not paying rent. It's somewhat the same, similar.
Yeah.
A homeowner, a property owner can do it on their own through the sheriff's office and through, you know, filing the proper stuff with the court. But typically they go to an attorney to help them do this. Is like Waller and Waller did Waterloo Road, the big cleanup we had a couple of years ago. He looked at those folks to remove, if you remember, we had to like remove all of those people off of that property. Sheriff's office on that one.
I think what I'm worried about is, I mean, there's different reasons people would allow someone to live in an RV on their property. One of the reasons is I can't afford anything, and so I'm going to get some renters. I'm using the quotes. Those are the same individuals who are not going to be able to afford to go to a lawyer to evict people. And so that, I guess that's one of the things I want to think about when we put this code in place that says you can live, we're not going to make you a code criminal to live in an RV on someone's property, is I don't want to set people up for the inability to use their property. If somebody is direct discharging sewage on my property, I'm not going through a legal process. I'm going through a get off my land process. And it could involve other things. I mean, it's not going to be charming. So, as most things I do aren't. But I guess I was just operating that conversation. I was operating under a very real assumption that you as the property owner held the ultimate rights in those scenarios. If that's not the case and you have to go through all of this, then I think I might
I'm concerned about that too. You're absolutely right. Thank you for bringing that up.
So one condition on this particular property is, of course, the deceased. So the folks on the property are claiming to the sister that they had a lease with the deceased person. So then they have established home. And so that's
they
why
present, did they provide it?
No.
Let's be clear.
No.
Under county law,
yeah,
they
no.
have no.
Oh, I 100% agree with you.
It's against the law to have an RV on the property.
Lease right now is illegal.
It's in the legal
100%.
Lease.
Yeah.
And the homeowner is the ones that's going to get in trouble from the county, from the sheriff, because
Absolutely.
They're the ones who are culpable about having this drainage.
Yeah. So one reason we actually were finally just went to a post on this is for that exact thing. So we have been. And I don't know if this is COVID related and Mike can speak to that, but on the RV front, we're not just like running people out who are living in RVs if they have proper sewage and water, because people don't have anywhere to live.
Perfect.
But these guys are direct discharging and the neighbors are complaining and the water system has issues. So when we put a health officer's order on, the sheriff's office has to enforce it.
But
so that is another piece there that gives them a tool. It actually helps the lawyer.
I think where we're going crazy, because I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one going crazy at this moment, is it's code illegal right now. You're not allowed to do this. we tell people, oh, you got to plant this shrub here and you can't move into your house because you did this. And I mean, do we not do this to people all the time?
Right.
Now, you're not allowed to have an RV. You're not allowed to desk. I mean, I appreciate the health officer, but before even the health officer, don't we have the authority to say, you can't live like this? It's against the rules. Mm-hmm. So part of what I think this conversation is going to go in circles, I mean, I'm interested in all this, sure. But part of the fundamental problem with code enforcement is there's no there, right? And everybody knows it. I know it. I tell people if I think the code violation's stupid, which half the time I do, as we know, I say, we're not going to do anything about that. We'll never take you to court over it. So it's up to you how many letters you want to get in the mail, because that's all we're going to do to you. And everybody's learning that. I mean, most people want to do the right thing. So we're counting on good people doing the right thing when they know the rules. That's how our whole system works. But this, there should be zero reason that these folks have to get a lawyer, because we have all the authority and right now in our code to say, get off their property. This is illegal.
Yes.
Illegal.
Yes.
That's what's confusing to us, is why do we have these rules and codes if there's no mechanism to make people follow them?
Yeah. Anyway. Well, the health officer order is our most direct way to compel compliance with the code when people are breaking the rules. And we know resources for next steps are very finite, but that's where the board might consider what options we have when it comes to compelling. The health officer order set is kind of the end of the line when it comes to public health authority. And if they continue to not comply, as Heather said, there are
we then bring the sheriff in.
We can bring the sheriff
in. Let's parse out that if they have a legal lease for some reason.
There's no such thing.
I'm just saying if they have, Michael, a legal lease, which they are right. There is no such thing, because we don't allow this unless it's in the temporary permit thing. But if, then it is subject to the landlord-tenant law. Without a legal lease, we saw this during COVID. Mm-hmm. We saw this where even the governor issued clarification that if it's not a legal lease, the eviction moratorium did not apply. So first of all, we don't have legal leases for RVs. So let's set that aside. Then you have the health officer. Your joint response team has gone out to properties with law enforcement at that point at which you've gotten voluntary compliance from an heir or a property owner. You know, there's a case where the daughter of an aging parent was allowing lots of her friends to come, and it grew into a big problem. And you did a joint response, and the sheriff showed up, and they basically waited while people were escorted off the property. So I don't want to give the illusion that that we cannot respond, because we have responded with these joint response team, and the sheriff has gone out and stood there and waited while you escorted people off properties. So let's be clear that what's a legal lease is subject to that. Right. But we don't have legal leases if it violates our law. And then that we do have the option to engage the sheriff. And we can go into that conversation later. I think that's really important that we understand parse out those two conversations.
I understand what's next with some of these are our highest priority, these top four or five.
Okay.
So this seems like one to star for further discussion on what's next.
Definitely.
Because we're in budget,
right,
and we spend a lot of money on law enforcement. I guess I crazily had the expectation they were doing it.
And I think that's where you guys have to bring them in, is when you bring them in, when you have all the legal authorities, either through the health officer or where the courts have acted, you bring them in.
Yeah, our code allows collaboration with law enforcement and state law, and especially when a health officer order is issued. There's also then the legal actions and remedies available, a possibility of a lien, which other counties exercise.
A lien, locking doors.
Right.
The sheriff can lock a door and say, no, this is not subject to occupancy. We're going to talk about that on the next one.
They can't post a no trespassing sign, and when the person walks on the property,
they can. They did that on Rusan.
Arrest them for being a trespasser. Like, I don't that to me doesn't warrant. I mean, respectfully, it doesn't warrant this conversation. That warrants a phone call and an arrest.
See, and once the health officer's orders in, once the health officer's order saying they can't,
but I'm going.
Then the sheriff has to, right? So it's
but not that they have to. If I post a no trespassing sign on my property and somebody comes, I need us to like not bureaucrat this and really get down to what I'm saying here for a second. If I post a no trespassing sign on my property and someone comes on my property and will not leave, I would call 911 and say, I have a trespasser.
Yeah.
And then law enforcement will come and they will remove that person from my property. Will they not do that?
Yes.
So
here we have trespassers. We have no legal lease. We have no ability for these people to be on someone's property. So we pick up that phone. We call 911, which we're now paying 0.2% more for. And we call the sheriff. And the sheriff goes out and they arrest the people who are trespassing. And I don't find this to be I understand what we're saying about, but I don't find this to be as complicated as we made this one. This one to me is literally like, we have a paid for mechanism in our judicial system and our legal system and our sheriff system that says you trespass, you're going to get a violation. You're going to show up in court. If you don't show up in court, you're going to get a warrant. If you don't get your warrant, you go to the jail. I've not heard of a simpler one yet. And that's where I don't want us to overcomplicate the things that are simple. This is a 911 arrest call.
They also are polluting a wetland. There's all sorts of fines or should be associated with this level of pollution into a wetland.
So you've got a sister that is passed and a sister that's living there, and the sister that's living there certainly can always call 911.
The part about the structure itself is a different conversation that might involve the health officer. The people living in the RV are trespassers.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, I can't speak for the sheriff any longer, but in my experience, again, like we're talking about two separate things where, and I can't speak for the PA's office either, but again, with experience in this matter, like when someone establishes residency, it's different than if the homeowner called and said, hey, there's somebody pulling an RV in on my property right now.
I just had one hauled off the back end of my.
If you called and said, hey, there's some guy pulling an RV in my backyard right now. Yeah. The sheriff's going to respond. He's going to remove that person or have them removed because it's trespassing. But if you have been invited to live there and you've established residency there, whether it's from the daughter or the sister or whoever, like we can't just go out there.
Michael, let me clarify again what I said a minute ago.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I'm interrupting. That's rude of me.
Yeah.
It's not a legal residency if it's illegal to have a lease on that. So let's be clear.
I'm not talking about leases or anything like that.
But even it's not legal for them to allow somebody to live on their property.
The daughter wasn't an officer of the county, of the government. The daughter had no authority to tell people they could put the house there in the first place.
That
she
RV.
The RV. She had no authority to grant.
I mean, we can certainly ask for an LAR to say if it's an illegal occupancy, it is not subject to the landlord-tenant law.
Yeah.
I know that was clarified because we got that clarified during the eviction moratorium.
I'm not saying it's subject to the landlord-tenant law. I'm saying it's similar in the mechanism for removing the folks.
And the homestead thing.
Well,
the Homestead Act. That's right. We had with the Marissa on the Homestead Act.
It would be different.
That got changed.
And we have a mechanism. Our mechanism doesn't work. The mechanism is, like you said, send a letter, send another letter, send a third letter, beg them some more. And then Mike writes a 10-page enforcement order that nobody enforces.
Right. And I get that on traditional code enforcement. But this one felt different because it seems like it's trespassing. I mean, I would love to live in it. There's a couple houses on Shore Avenue. Pretty nice.
Hey, let's go set up the tents.
I'm moving in. They can't kick me out. I'm just good.
They're not there 3/4 of the year.
They won't know this will be there 6 months. We've established that this is our home now.
We live yep. here. Thanks for playing. That $13 million house you're trying to sell, that's now mine? Like, at some point I get it, but I'm also not convinced that we're not putting up interpretation barriers that we're so afraid of making a mistake. And I get this is a sheriff conversation, but again, going back to budgeting, we hold a lot of budget for deputies to be hired. I know this isn't you. I'm talking to the sheriff and he's not here. Maybe if this is not, if we're too afraid to do law enforcement, I'm going to take that money and put it somewhere else.
Right.
Because either we are doing it or we are not doing it. But I'm not paying a bunch of people to drive around in fast cars to sit there and say, well, I don't know if I can do that because of some interpretation of some, no. And trespassing, like back in the establishment of this country, people understood trespassing. I've been watching Yellowstone 1893. You go on somebody's property, you don't come back off, right? Like this is old school American rules. Private property is private property. If you don't want somebody on your property, you call law enforcement and you get them off. That's how we do it nowadays. Back in the day, they didn't even call. So now we call law enforcement and you get people off your property. And that just seems fundamental, not complicated, basic rules. And anything else is just blah, blah, blah.
Commissioner, yeah. Chair, should we bring, yeah. This is a conversation with Rick at some point about clarification.
Right. And I want to, we have others and we want to get moving, but I think it's clear that the board's going to want to be kept apprised of the process of this and that this one is thank you for having it as a high priority.
Yes.
Because this is clearly a high priority.
For open us, septic's but. Just not a good thing.
Oh, okay. I will say us recently issuing the health officer order with Dr. Librand taking that action, and that was a very recent action, that does give the sheriff a tool. And so our next step will be to
bring him
pick up the phone call. They are participating in the case review team starting at the next meeting. So we've only had one initial meeting. They weren't able to attend, but they will be attending going forward.
You need to go.
Yeah. We had good representation also from the PAs. So that's you're welcome to join. Yeah,
we can have one without a public meeting.
Actually, that would
Maple Grove.
Maple Grove.
They are still living in the home, so it's one thing that they are getting a repair permit. There are people still occupying that home on weekends. I know you wouldn't necessarily know that. It just happens to be not far from where I live and walk the dog.
Okay.
And what I hear.
Well, to the sheriff's credit, they did send folks out to the house to talk to the people. I mean, we have the
I want to be clear that until that is approved and we've got the repairs made, this has been a multi-year problem on a public beach where children play, people launch their kayaks, and we've had hits of high E. coli. I want more fervent action than, and if they're going to continue to try to occupy the home, we can lock it.
I do. Our code, the next step that's outlined for this type of septic situation would be seeking injunctive action to enforce the health officer order involving.
So what that, do you need to seek injunctive action on something board, that's been multiple years?
The board going and to the prosecuting attorney's smells. Office.
Let's have the meeting and move forward with it.
Okay, and we just needed to have that in.
They
in
do have
that
a
request
permit in review right now.
I get that they have a repair permit, and that's fine. Just stay out of the house until then.
No one should be living in that house. The woman, the two ladies who own it, one lives down the street, and one lives in Eastern Washington, and they're both in their 80s, and those are their grandchildren, and they've been told not to go there, so they can be arrested. They do not own the house. They don't have rights to be there.
Okay, I'm so frustrated by this particular one because it's on a public beach.
Okay,
so and at a public park.
That these homeowners have less rights than the squatters on the other people's property, because that's how I just heard that conversation. Just keep going. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but apparently it's easy to kick people out of the house even though there might be the owners, but we couldn't get the squatters off the property.
Well, it's the grandchildren partying on the weekends. That's a little different.
But it's still the grandchildren's violating the law.
Yeah.
At some point, though,
I get it.
Well, I need this job to make a little bit more sense on a day-to-day basis. Because, again, They're related to the people. These are people who don't even want these people on their property. At least these property owners would want these people on the property, and we seem to have more law enforcement mechanisms for them. Okay, keep going. I literally go home at the end of these days and do not understand how you're supposed to make a good decision when everything doesn't make sense. It's like we just woke up one day and said, hey, let's regulate the most stupid things we can think of and make them the most contradictory, and then sit here and say, hey, we're making good decisions for the citizens. This is crazy train making. I need behavioral health services after these meetings.
Well,
they don't make sense.
I think it is maybe a helpful one to clarify board direction on, because we do have a number of on-site failures within the shoreline that contribute to water quality issues, public recreational access, and historically, you know, we've limited actions related to those. We always work on voluntary compliance, trying to work with homeowners. That's always the first step, and these only rise up after many years trying to correct them in other ways.
Agreed to move forward for a while, and then they stopped. So I agree with your pathway. Voluntary compliance, let's not bring out the big hammer. But then they stopped, and it wasn't until you went back and red-tagged the house that they finally applied for a permit.
And again, through that public health and safety lens, because of the impact more broadly on, you know, the water quality, the recreational area. But the other case also a very high priority, and we will follow up with.
If you had a house that was leaking active sewage on the boat ramp at Goss Lake, you'd have an opinion here?
I would.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we had this robust conversation about how we couldn't review illegal squats on somebody's property. And then all of a sudden it was like, well, we're going to move these people who have some legal association with the house. And that seemed easier. And to me, the first one should have been the no-brainer one. And this one would have had more complications too.
Sure,
but this was an easy pick up the phone and call the sheriff. And the other one wasn't. And that makes no sense to me.
Oh, no. To be clear, the first one we can easily coordinate now that we've issued the health officer order. So we will coordinate with the sheriff. The legal lift for either of them, if the board were to direct, will be a big lift either way.
The injunction.
The injunction is always a big lift. And that would just be the legal mechanism, really, with any of these cases where a health officer order has been issued.
So
to take that legal step. And it is a big lift.
Can I ask a clarifying question? I am not trying to punish the owners while their permit is in place. I just want them to stop allowing people to live there or rent that property.
Right.
And so here's the other piece of that. They call weekly asking us to take the red tag down because they're making steps. And we say no, it doesn't come down until we squirt test that system that's in the ground and is serving the house. And when we approve it and sign it off, then the tags come off. So that's new information to us that it's still being inhabited, because they're telling us
it's not inhabited all the time. No, it's Labor Day weekend.
It's the grandkids.
So it's something for the board to consider. How we will continue with our process. The board can schedule.
I don't know that we, with the Madam Chair, no, it needs injunction if we can get people to stop going there. I don't know.
That's fine. We can't do an injunction while the repair permits under review, but
you could explore options in a follow-up meeting with the PA.
And it's consistency and fairness, because there was somebody else who was not allowed to be in their home for several years prior to my getting elected on a red tag, and you know who I'm talking about, and that they then connected to the sewer system that was put in place in Maple Grove, and now they have access to a place to live. We can't have one set of rules for one person and one set of rules for another. I think all of us want us to be consistent.
Sure.
So the next one that's high is also in Oak Harbor.
Yeah. So this is a mobile home park that the county has worked, you know, really hard behind the scenes to find a solution for years. We have multiple failed drain fields, working closely with the city of Oak Harbor on a potential solution. This really, water system issues as well. I don't know. Planning has been involved as well. Really, really the next step for this mobile home park, the city has provided a number of potential remedies, options to effectively address the situation. And our recommendation to the board is really, at this point, we've exhausted kind of voluntary compliance measures, and kind of, we really need them to select a a path forward that would resolve the issue. Okay.
They selected a path, but it does not resolve the issue.
Can we, can we talk with Human Services about when that Oak Harbor Road apartment complex will be open and then see about moving those people out of there? The only way these folks are going to be compliant is when they stop collecting rent from the lot fees from the tenant. And we've got to get those tenants other options before we can do any evicting. So we need to make sure we have a place to move them.
Sure.
And in reality, we have a value difference right now. So if what they want to do is maximize the value of the property, they're going to see how little their property's worth with no residents on it and no working septic. And they can then, it will be then zoned industrial in the overcapacity and industrial zone of Oak Harbor, and they can wait till somebody wants to put something in there.
Right.
Or they can fix their system and get their lot rent. But we need Human Services to make sure that we can get those folks moved out. Right. They have,
because we do currently, Health has a, they have a, I'm forgetting the word right now, but their license expires December 31st this year, and we have told them that we will not renew until they fix their issues. So right now they have a
provisional.
Thank you. I cannot come with the word.
It's for their MHP license.
Yeah. Yeah, so the mobile home park. So, and that affects their ability to collect rent.
I mean, their tenants aren't going to know that. I mean, this is a real.
No, this would be a PA thing. We'd have to.
Yeah, this is a real equity problem. And also huge. We need to have an option to rehouse in order to go to the next steps with the property. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any estimate how many people are living there?
There are
50 or 60 56
mobiles.
Oh my God.
And there's a, and it's not just the mobiles. They also, separate from the park, they own some apartment complexes up here off Oak Harbor Road and another mobile that's all kind of part of the convo. So that's all affordable housing that has surfacing and sewage and or really awful water system. We've had to bring the state in to bring the water system up to, you know, potable multiple times. And so the real key was that hookup to the city, and they have decided against that. They decided they want to petition to be zoned residential again, and they've lost that four times.
They're not going to get zoned residential then.
So I have told the owner that thinks that I'm her, you know, personal septic consultant, that I am no longer available for this because I'm going to be the person that has to enforce on her and close her park. So she needs to find someone else to work with on that.
Is this an option for a pilot project? We're talking about maybe four pilot projects.
The challenge is the site. Yeah. They'd have to find an offsite area, which would be a challenge potentially, but it's something we can,
potentially. We could put a giant mound that City of Oak Harbor would have to look at.
Been offered the ability to hook up to the city's
system. Yeah, so that's what I was thinking.
And that was our original frustration with the city. The city has found a way to do that. They found a property owner who's willing to allow them to put the lift station on their property. It's just expensive. Mm-hmm. We, without us all knowing, have probably maybe offered that they could, through our infrastructure dollars with housing dollars, because this is affordable housing, we have said we would consider looking at you for a possible grant allocation to help offset this cost, but explain to the property owners that if you get public funds, you're going to have to sign something that says that you're not going to repurpose that housing for a higher income level or try to redevelop, because you're under a conditional use. Basically, you've got the wrong activity in the zone. The city's willing to look the other way on that. So are we willing to look the other way on that? But what we need you to do is to get this done. And oh, by the way, we'll look to find ways to help offsite the cost. So I cannot think of what else government can offer to these people more than a solution and funding to help with the solution. And all they had to do was deed restrict in order to do that. What they really want to do is develop to a much higher potential, but they're not understanding that they don't have the zoning, the infrastructure. They don't have any mechanism to do what they think they're going to do. They bought a bad piece of property for their vision, and there's not a pathway for that. So their best and highest use right now is actually what they have. They have to put infrastructure in, and they're not willing to do it, or they don't have the money to do it. The consequence is those folks are going to have to go. And so, and that's a consequence for the people too. Yeah. So that is a hard one.
Yeah.
Because they've been given all the solutions now.
Oh, they've had 9 years of my dedicated time tracking down state funding, them down.
They've got all the solutions.
They have had all the hands held and have chosen something that just basically is like throat punched to me, but anyway.
We have not issued a health officer order on this one. We've issued notices of violation in the past. Dr. Libran's always very, I won't speak for him too much, but I know he's always looks through an equity lens. When we think about an order, he's always reluctant to issue an order of eviction when we have, critical housing needs, but he can issue other orders like compelling them to find a functional solution and address the septic and water quality issues. So that is still within our toolbox within public health as a next step we could take.
So when you say phase escalation, the health officer order would be next, but I hear Commissioner Johnson making sure we have a plan for the residents if we go that direction.
So both of those. Okay, so we'll connect with Human Services and they were able to join our first meeting. It's great.
Great.
This last one actually, we'll let Mike, if you have, I think more of the background on this case. The Moonlight Drive.
Moonlight, yeah. That's a mental health issue that's been going on for many years. We've restarted the process again with sending him another notice of violation, but I think that's going to come down to the property owner having to evict him from that land as well. I don't recall if it's his land. He is the property owner, yeah. It's again, it's someone living in a camper and on a small corner lot.
In the middle of the subdivision.
It's been there for a very long time. South Moonlight Drive. Mm-hmm. Sure, if it's been there 100 times, mm-hmm. not more. Definitely more of a mental health issue than it is anything else, I believe.
Sure. I know we have health violations as well with sewage and solid waste issues that will look at our NOV process. And this one's more, I think, for board awareness at this point, if you hear from your constituents.
With this parcel as well.
Yeah.
So without a sheriff's escort.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great.
Are they going to need a place to put the person? I'm trying to look it up.
Well, as of 2 weeks ago, he was already a guest of ours. I don't know if he's out yet.
Okay.
Oh, I wasn't aware.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of other residency, but I guess that is an option.
Yeah.
You know, the rest of these are all identified as medium, but what's so interesting is most of them have to do with junk vehicles and RVs being used as dwellings, and there's no water or sewage or electrical. And so that's the thing that we, thank you, Commissioner Johnson, for raising this. Our next conversation is we're going to talk about RVs as housing a little bit with the planning and, yeah, we need to make sure that what actions we take in our comp plan don't exacerbate the existing situation.
Sure.
I'd like to be able to go through all of these, but we really don't have the time unless my colleagues want to address any specific ones. There's one that I'm looking at right now on Zylstra. No, not, is it the Zylstra one? Yeah. So that's kind of that. So did you have any other things you wanted to ask Janet?
I do.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. One other one.
Well, if there's,
well, we did through all the high ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can reach
back and
do
the medium ones on a one-on-one because I think behind, Commissioner.
We're behind a little bit.
You can come back to us on the medium ones.
Okay. And we'll keep this updated. We'll continue meeting.
I think we're really, we're very engaged. And we're really grateful that you guys are working together to try to find solutions for these. And moving forward, we support taking action, totally support taking action. And if injunctions are necessary, we're open to that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay.
Goldie Road, sorry.
Yes, ma'am, that was the one I was going to clarify for you.
Okay, because why do they have a business license?
It's an unlicensed business.
It's unpermitted, but is it like, do they have to have a state business license, pay state taxes, do all the things? Why are they even getting a business license? Why are
that
we not
part? I don't know. That's not me. The health side of it is the only part I'm aware of.
Right. But why wouldn't health call the business license place and say this business can't operate here because of blah, blah, blah? Their business license gets pulled.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I think they're unlicensed.
Do they have a business license? Because it's their unpermitted auto shop.
Unpermitted, even.
I imagine it's sort of doing mechanics in their backyard kind of a thing,
yep.
Right?
Yep, there's more.
Like, I unpermitted to me meant the building, the structure, the they don't have an operating license.
Right, they're doing.
They have an illegal business.
Yeah, exactly. But there's also other reports. Of stuff going on there, but just the thing I wanted to let you know is that this is another one where it's an industrial zone.
Yeah.
And so even though that house has been there since eons and then it got industrialized, City of Oak Harbor just let me know that they cannot connect that house because it's residential in the wrong zone, and they won't. So those houses out there, even though there's no perk, they don't have an option. So this one, I'm not sure exactly.
I mean, they're right. I mean, this is.
I know.
So this is the precursor to what's going to happen in all of the UGA areas that we're saying have to go into the city. Is that when someone's system fails, we are going to tell them you can't replace your house. You can't make your improvements. You can't fix this system unless you pay to hook up to that city system. Yep. That's what we're about to tell all of these people, is that until you pay the $50,000 to hook up to that system, you will not be able to live, occupy, or be in your home. That's the significance of what that UGA conversation means.
Mm-hmm.
Here, this is what's happening, is that you have a non-conforming use. The zoning says you can replace it if you're this. You're not this. Now your infrastructure is failing. If they want to be industrial, they can hook up. But they're not allowed to hook up when what they want to do is outside of the zone.
Is the rezone of an owner-occupied business in an industrial area a rezone, if they're going to be in the expanded UGA, a rezone that happens at the county or that happens at the city?
I mean, that's what the city is saying. What they're saying to us right now is that we need to own the politics of that. That they will not take those properties in and put them on their system until they're compliant. Basically, is what I'm understanding. They need, and so what they want us to do is to simply say no. You can't have this non-conforming use under the city's rules, and we're going to just let that.
I hear you, but they don't get to have it both ways. They want to expand the UGA for this, but not for that. You get both sides of that conversation. I mean, and I know we're off topic, so
we're telling them you have to use the existing UGA. They're telling us fine. No, they're not telling us fine, but the answer to that's going to be fine, but you need to make sure that nothing goes on in that existing UGA that
it's
is not compliant.
Is it?
It is our job if it's ours. It's on it. So yes,
if it's ours.
It's ours. Because they haven't taken it yet. But what they're asking for us is certainty that there won't be any more utilization of things that make it impossible for those properties to get annexed in within the next however many years. So they're asking us to own all the politics, all the no, all the anger, all the you can't do this. And then when it gets to a point where everybody can't redevelop and it's, the system fails, then maybe they'll annex that all in. But we have to undervalue all that property and those homeowner experiences first so that it forces redevelopment. Really, that's what they're asking us to do, I think. That's how I understand what we're having to do. That's the choice we made by lowering the population allocation, was we took those politics. It's a good time. Okay, but here's what I don't understand is that who enforces if you have a business license or not? Can I just open up a business and not be licensed in any way?
Of course you can.
Yeah.
Until somebody catches you.
Awesome.
Okay. No, there are planning requirements in unincorporated Island County.
I mean, as far as the state,
yeah,
the county doesn't issue business licenses.
Right.
The
no.
The state
right.
does.
State
and that, and that involves going online and saying, I want to open a bicycle shop.
So,
give me a business license. I pay you so much money, absolutely. And you get a business license. It's that easy.
But you have to pay taxes on these things.
Right.
I mean, this is the thing, is that there's some mechanism somewhere where you've actually broken a law more than just what we're talking about here. What phone call gets made to that place that says, here's your consequence. You do not have a business license. So probably they're not paying business taxes. I think you go to jail for that. I mean, I'm not trying to be harsh to these people, but I'm trying to understand why anybody plays by any rules if there's no consequence anywhere. There is a consequence. Where is it at?
But isn't there a permitted use in for different types of occupation? So if there wasn't a permitted
That's the
use,
unpermitted part. But what I was trying to question was why wouldn't we make a phone call to the licensing agency to say you cannot give this business a license to operate, right? You're going to... And so when you file your taxes, you just file taxes as an unlicensed illegal business and you just
taxes as a person, as an individual.
Yeah, it's all under the table. You just
he's probably getting cash for the work that
you
he
take
does.
Cash and you keep everything off the books. And so the IRS never knows about it.
Until it's reported.
Someplace there's a NARC outline. That's what I'm saying. It's someplace you go and you report the violator. It feels like we know there's a violator, that there should be a place we call that notifies that there's a violator. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the technical name is not NARC outline, but it functions the same.
File a complaint.
I believe both the Department of Revenue and Washington State has a way in which you can inquire a business license and report a business that's not operating under the law.
Yes, but
yeah, I added that in my notes.
Cool. And whether they do anything at the state after that action, that's the question.
The board's will is for our staff to be doing.
There's a little common.
There's laws, there's RCWs around the assessors not being able to do that specifically, but I don't know in code enforcement. So that's
we are so far afield at this
point. They are. I mean, I'm going to take something farther.
I'm not going to go into the prosecutor. I'm not going to go into a courtroom with a prosecutor until we've exercised every other tool we have.
Right.
And to me, other agencies using their regulatory authority is a tool that we are allowed to use to avoid taking our own citizens to court. That's what I don't want to do. Personally, I don't like that. So that's where I'm trying to get us to think through what are all of the resources we have and leverage. If it's not ours, who else has it to try to get compliance? Because that's all we really care about.
Right.
I don't care about their business license, to be honest. I find it odd, but what I care about is the part we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to avoid going into a courtroom if there's other mechanisms that can compel them to do this that we're not using.
Right. So we'll research that possibility. Would the board like to see a progress update on these priority cases?
Sure. Yeah. You have historically, Michael, given us by district. I assume we can see everybody's, yeah. But you have a spreadsheet where you track progress. And I know either you've gone over these with me or you've gone over these with me in the past where you said this is what's going on in terms of the compliance.
Does that have all of your
part of the that's may or may not involve the SEP, the public health. Yeah. That was very useful, Michael. That was a very useful tool for us to stay aware of what's happening in our district and be informed that when the constituents say you're not doing anything, I say, well, actually it went to compliance and they've assigned it to here and there and it gives us tools. So having that tool, that report was really useful. I appreciated it. I just want to say.
Okay.
The enlightening thing for me in this conversation was the number of things at once. I always think of all of these cases being down in my district.
No, they're not.
My district only has half the cases.
Maybe 75%.
No, most of the ones that are identified as high are out of district one.
Well, and they frankly have done, there was a whole lot of really serious issues up in North Whidbey that they have been working diligently to resolve. Like you talked about the, what's the name of that road, Jill? Where you did the response and you got
Waterloo.
Waterloo, thank you.
Road.
Yeah, so they've done a ton of really, and I think it's important we acknowledge they've done a lot of really good work on some pretty tough properties.
What's not on the list?
Yeah. What's not on the list is also useful information.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Really appreciate it. We're going to move to, Jonathan, you have to stay. We're going to move to planning.
Comfortable chair.
Can we do the...
What do you want to do?
I'm asking if we could do the comp plan code update conversation or the fee schedule first before the CRS, because I always have been back
to the CRS.
Okay.
I need to recover from the last one, and PBRS always makes me mad because I think it's a scheme. Rich people deferring their taxes to poor people. It's what it is. It's what it is.
But it's not about Austin, right?
No, it's not about Austin, but you're not giving you transition fine between the last conversation that upset me and the next one. So I tried.
She did try.
Do a buffer.
If you want to come back later, Austin, it might go easier for you.
That's going to give you control.
Well, we can do that if you want to. Okay. It's fine either way.
It'll be fine.
Yes.
This is systemic racism in its purest form. It's what it is. But it's what it is.
He hasn't even presented yet, Jill.
Yeah, the whole program is what that is. It's a tax shift from people who wrote the laws who have the ability to afford nice property to those who have the ability to not afford nice property in the name of the greater good. And that is exactly what systemic racism is. It is people who wrote laws to favor themselves and disenfranchise others. And that's what this program does. But Austin, you key it up.
Thanks. Why am I blanking on where to share it right now?
I disagree that this is a systemic racism. Go ahead, Austin.
If you can find me one poor person that wrote the PBRS law, but that's not who writes it. It was written for people who own land to protect the land, and then they all put their nice house on it, and then they want tax credit so they don't have to pay as much to enjoy their own property. But tell me how I'm wrong. Go.
It's all sure. If you enjoying their property. Go ahead.
Can we go after the application and address the philosophical things separately?
Sounds good. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, commissioners. It's good to see you all. My name is Austin Hufnagel, for the record. I'm an associate planner with the Island County Planning Department. I'm going to be presenting today on two PBRS applications for consideration and entry into the public benefit rating system for open space classification. The two applications are 347-24 for Owners LaPlace and then application 400-24 for Golic. On the screen here, we have the first one, which is for 347-24, property owners Joseph and Teresa Rodriguez LaPlace. They're proposing to dedicate 26.31 acres across five separate parcels. They're all zoned as rural. The total acreage is 27.34. Critical areas on site that we have are wetlands, streams, steep slopes, and aquifer recharge areas.
What kind of wetlands?
I believe for this one it's a Category B wetland, so high priority resource. List of open space resources on site for high priority, we have Category B wetlands. We have a mapped fish stream. Medium priority consists of geohazard buffer protection areas. In terms of bonus points, we have surface water quality buffers, critical aquifer recharge areas. They're adjacent to designated forest land, so a lot of the surrounding property near them, the adjacent property, are already in a current use program. They also intend to do some limited public educational access, so I believe they want to have folks come out there for certain workshops or educational courses, things like that.
They're required to, or you believe they do?
So they're not required to, they've elected to do it themselves.
Right, but you're giving them points for it?
Yeah, we were going to give them points. Do it? Well, we're going to hold them to do it. That's part of our recommended conditions.
So it's required.
Yeah, we would require that they do that, correct. And then they plan to execute a conservation easement with the Whidbey Conservation, with the Whidbey Camino Land Trust. So they actually
won't be duplicative, will they?
What was that? For this one, I don't believe it's a duplicate, but I can check that for you.
Well, if they do a conservation easement, right?
Yeah.
Why would they need the we're already getting value then. So why would we pay for it through PBRS if they're getting a conservation easement? The public then gets the value through the easement. They're getting bought out for that.
They donated it.
They're donating the easement.
So if they're donating the packet, if they're donating it, then that's so any parcels that are in a conservation easement, this is a conversation we've had before, and one I actually agree that if it's donated into the land trust as conservation easement or donated to the land trust, one, if it's donated to the land trust, it's not their parcel anyway, and it comes out of this project or this proposal.
Right.
But if they are putting the conservation easement on there, they've already received value for that part of the parcel. So I would concur that if the parcel is under conservation easement, it should not then also get a PBRS benefit. It's already gotten a benefit in the conservation easement. That's one place where I don't disagree with Commissioner Johnson.
If they bought it, purchased
as an easement, right. But if it was donated,
I feel different if it's donated.
Yeah.
It also is complicated because we're talking seven parcels, and is the conservation easement over the totality of the seven parcels, or is it over one trail going through one parcel?
So
conservation easements come in many different types.
From my understanding, the conservation easement encompasses all the five parcels collectively, and then they're actually slated aside a portion to remain as the home site. Everything else is going to be within the conservation easement, and it is being dedicated. Correct.
They're donating the easement. They're not getting a quid pro quo for the easement.
It's my understanding, yeah.
The agreement's in the packet, and when I read it this morning, it says donated very clearly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So they're saying that Whidbey Camino Land Trust can do what they wish on these parcels?
No, they're saying the land trust has a conservation easement for access.
Or X for them to remain as open space,
right?
Conserved land.
Why would you? This is actually a question. This isn't a Jill Snarky question. This is a real question that I don't understand. Why would you need PBRS if you gave a conservation easement over the property? The easement's in perpetuity, right?
Theoretically.
And then it would remove the development potential off the property. So then what would you get from the PBRS that you wouldn't get from the easement?
The tax benefit.
But so, the tax benefit is based on, I thought the tax benefit was based on the value and potential of the property. This is basically undevelopable property, which is kind of what PBRS does, is it takes down your development potential and it offsets what you would pay for taxes if you developed it. So I'm really not understanding what you're putting PBRS on if the easement already did it.
So that's an interesting question. It might take the assessor to come and weigh in on that, on how they value the property differently once there's a conservation easement on it. But the PBRS points would take away from whatever the value of the property is. So whether the value is reduced because of that easement or it's a highest and best use, I think the assessor would take that into account. But I think we'd need them to weigh in on that question.
So if you have a conservation, so I had a property that I later donated, so it's not relevant, but if you have a conservation easement, then you have, and I considered this, then you have reduced value because it's no longer developable. Mm-hmm. But what PBRS does on, if it's been donated on top of that is, still gives you a percentage reduction on that rural not able to be developed later.
Right.
So it's an additional.
But you can't do anything with it anyway. So I'm trying to understand this. So PBRS stands for public benefit, right? Rating system. If the public benefit exists, the preservation, is that right? Or conservation? I got the words mixed up as we've learned. If the conservation benefit exists under the easement, then what is the public benefit why would we be giving a public benefit to further reduce the taxation? The public benefit exists through the conservation easement. You see what I'm saying? That is all the points we are given are preserved under the conservation easement. And that then reduces taxes because the development's gone away. So my understanding of PBRS was that you could reduce your taxes, somewhat live on the property differently. There aren't necessarily easements associated with it. If there are, we've said we're not double paying you for a benefit that the public's purchased before. I get that they're donating this.
Yeah,
but I'm if anybody understands, I need some help because I don't understand what the public is getting that they're not getting from the easement. And I don't understand what the homeowner is getting other than further reduction of taxes, but you're already getting that through the easement. So, and also, I guess I'm not, I guess going back to, well, if they donated or they not, the public's not getting anything more. They're not getting anything more from PBRS than they got from the easement.
So I hear what you're saying, and there is kind of a conflict there. I would say the way the PBRS program is written right now, it offers points for folks who have a conservation easement. So when we get an application with this conservation easement, they are eligible for those points. If the board has a philosophical problem with giving points when a conservation easement already exists to further reduce the tax benefit, then we need to amend the program.
But for this application, it's subject to the current rules in the program.
But the board can say yes or no. I mean, we don't have to say yes to the program. We always have this problem with people who say the rules say this, so you have to do it. The rules say you have to open it right away, but we don't do that. So, I mean, there's nothing that says we have to do this. I'm just trying to understand because this program got written largely, maybe not largely, in part, because we were trying to get people off, people were getting kicked out of current use programs, but we still wanted them to not convert their property into developable land. So my guess is that some language got written in there to help with that. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to like legitimately understand mm-hmm. why we would tax shift, that's what this program is, tax shift to other taxpayers and say, you have to pay more because we're getting this public benefit if the public benefit already exists. Then I don't understand the value of the program to the public versus just the property owner. That's what I need to understand better. And that this is actually not just me trying to make an alternate point of view so that both tensions are at the table. This is actually a legitimate, I don't understand question.
Go ahead, Jen.
Where our goal today is to schedule a public hearing. I think these are legitimate questions that you have time to bring back before the public hearing.
I agree. It's something I think we'd like to chew on and get an answer to you.
I think both of the applications have the same issue. Both of them are yes. conservation easement and public benefit.
That's correct.
Raises. And so I would encourage you guys to get together with David Guy mm-hmm. in the assessor's office and so that you can explain to us why the public would benefit from a property having both a conservation easement and a PBRS status.
Because if there's something that's allowed in the easement that the PBRS protects against, that's something I could understand. But I...
Like public access or something like that?
Well, or... Or if the easement allowed them to clear cut, for example, and then the PBRS didn't, then I would understand the PBRS, but I need to understand what we get from the double protection again.
Understood.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you need to have both of these?
I don't think we need to talk about these as individual. Or do you want to have this come back to work session, or do you want it to go straight to public hearing? Both of these and have these conversations public hearing. I think work session would be better.
I do too.
Yeah. Can we bring these back to work session after you've talked with the assessor's office?
So we're not going to move it to public hearing.
Let's not move it to public hearing yet.
At this time. Okay. That was the action.
Because this could get heated. We don't want it to get heated in public hearing if we can avoid that.
And we'll look at the code that established that. So as you were saying, if it's allowed in the code, when you establish PBRS in the first place to allow for people to get a reduction in taxes for PBRS, but then also points, extra points for conservation easements and why we have both of those in there. And I think then that would make us look at the PBRS code per the board's direction on if there would need to be an update to the PBRS code to take that out if that's the board's direction. But we'll get information from, and we'll work with the assessor's office and we'll come back to work session.
Since the assessor's office being asked, can you ask also the tax shift value and what that looks like? I think that's a legitimate question to ask.
And I want to be clear, we're not being inconsistent with our decisions of the past. In the past, we've said no PBRS because you were already paid right. to have a conservation easement. That's different than donating
yeah,
your right. property for conservation easement.
I'm sure there's like an obvious thing we're missing, like some there. I'm sure there's something. I just don't know what it is. And I think somehow through time, we've lost what it is. So we just need to figure out why we did it that way. And then it will probably make more sense.
Yes.
Okay. That's fair.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, my brain was going to when we talked about being paid for the conservation
yeah.
versus the donor. So I appreciate the clarification.
Okay. So
good job, Austin. First table.
Thank you very much.
Having fun yet?
Oh, yeah. This is a blast. It's nice presenting. thank you all very much. I appreciate
thank
it.
You, Austin.
Thank you. Work. You. Okay. So, Jonathan and mm-hmm. Emily, do you want to do the comp plan code updates or do you want to do the update permit fee schedule next?
We've got John and Mike here for
okay.
comp plan code updates.
You can.
Well, I'm glad you were here for the last conversation. So we don't have to relive it.
Good morning, commissioners. John Lanier, Long Range Planning. I am just being promoted to a panelist here so that
I'm just
share
being promoted.
No, I'm now a panelist. Yeah. Okay. Then I will share my screen. So we've been talking comp plan and goals and policies a lot recently. In order to support these changes, planning's started preparing some development regulations updates, and we have a few of them here for you today. Okay. So the biggest impacts to local planning, and it's happening all over the state right now, are the affordable housing changes, the new HAPT tool as, you know, housing affordability planning tool. All right, that has given us all these numbers that, you know, we need to meet across the spectrum instead of just saying, okay, we need 5,000 houses. Now we drill down to the different levels. That is seen here. And as you remember from a lot of our previous conversations, we have a big deficit in the lower end of the spectrum. Okay. And that's what we're attempting to kind of start getting a handle on with some of the development regulations. We've got a couple of batches of them. This is the first one. So this is our first batch here, what we're talking about today, the code changes to support housing. So we want to talk about accessory dwelling units. We want to talk about co-living housing. We want to talk about recreational vehicles on single family lots. I know you've already been talking about that today. And we want to talk RV safe parking. So the last couple actually could potentially address some of the situations we have in the county now.
I agree.
Okay.
So far.
Okay, so I'm going to pass it off to Mike for the first couple changes.
And there's I'm Mike Podowski, Long Range Planner, and I'm going to talk about ADUs. So the table before you here shows in the left-hand column the changes that are required in the urban growth areas, and in the right-hand column is what that means for us. And so the House bill, which is now codified 1337, requires that in these areas we allow for there to be two ADUs, and they can be combinations of attached and detached, or, you know, both attached or both detached.
Okay, that was my question when I read this, was are we mandated to allow two ADUs and they get to decide, or can we say one attached and one detached?
They get to decide, and the two detached ADUs can be combined too. So it would look like what some people might think of as a duplex. So that's also an option.
And the county can't prescribe how we feel about any of those choices.
That's correct.
Okay, that was my question.
Why was I thinking that this only was related to cities, that this did not attach to counties?
I don't know.
Well, there's a mixture of state requirements. That some of the ones we're talking about now are just the municipal and non-municipal urban growth areas. So we own the non-municipal urban growth areas.
Okay.
So Freeland.
Freeland.
But what about
Oak Harbor, UGA?
But the unincorporated Oak Harbor, UGA.
Yes.
This would be allowed in, if our interlocal allows it, this would be allowed in those areas, or we're going to allow it in those areas and somebody could redevelop the lot.
We have to allow it. That's the thing that I was curious about.
If it's got residential zone. So this is the minimum. Yeah. Would we say this is the minimum density you could develop at then? Or would we say in the UGA, I'm not saying in the county, in mm-hmm. the UGA, would we say this is the minimum density? Or would we say, no, you have to hold off until you get city density?
I believe that this is the density. This is what you would be allowed to do, provided that you could meet the septic requirements to support the housing units.
And that would be we would set a minimum density for those areas, and then the allowance for the ADUs with that. So I think part of that, I had a question.
No, you're gonna, maybe. I think I'm going to be so confused that you're going to want to workshop this one for me with the UGAs, but I thought what the city wanted was basically for us to not allow development to happen lower than their potential, to try to force people to either devalue their property or hook up to their system. And so in order to do that, I'm wondering about in these UGAs, if we set this minimum density of 3 per lot, basically you have to have 3 units per lot, and then you can do improvements, or we're just saying no in those UGAs at all.
Oh my gosh. Sorry, I'm reading the law.
Okay. So I think it's kind of like in Freeland where we say, okay, you can develop here, but you have to plan for the future where we are going to have a sewer. So you have to have some space so that you can meet the eventual zoning designations. In the UGAs, we can develop. I can develop on my lot as long as I'm not like developing in a way that's going to preclude when the city comes in and there is city zoning there, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense, but the difference between Freeland and a municipal UGA are pretty significant in the sense that this density right here is actually precluding somebody coming in and redeveloping at urban potentials. So that's what I was trying to understand, is if we put this density on top of those UGAs and then we're trying to count it for our stuff, it's precluding them from maximizing the potential of those UGAs. If that is true, then I'm going to get on the team of, yeah, they need to expand because we're not going to densify this enough to make those UGAs absorb those population.
Yeah.
Different conversation. Sure. We can have it differently. I just didn't understand that.
I would say
I'm not opposed to the concept. I'm just trying to make sure I understand the UGA impact.
Yeah. Like on my lot now, I live in the UGA. I have a house on it, so I can't really develop any further now. But if I was hooked up to the city sewer, the area that, you know, is my septic and my backup septic no longer has to be a septic. So eventually I could have this 2 ADUs in
mother-in-law
my
backyard cottage,
and it would raise the density that I have towards more like the city density instead of 1 on a quarter acre.
So
I see this as being beneficial to those already developed neighborhoods, like what John is talking about. That doesn't preclude us from looking at areas that aren't currently developed in the UGA and redoing the zoning there to support more density, not this 1-for-5 thing they're trying to prevent.
Okay.
So this doesn't preclude us from protecting that land that is developable with some new zoning standards through an ILA. That's what the city wants to do with us.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah, I have one question. Just, I'm sorry, Jill.
No, you're fine.
I have one question just as I read this, because to the question in looking at just the final bill report, not the total legislation, it's emphasizing this in UGAs. And so I'm going to be seeking clarification on what this means in our unincorporated areas. Because as I read this, it really makes an emphasis on mandating this within UGAs, subject to all of the conditions that you went through, which are pretty big. We can't manage the size of the structure. We can't manage the height of the structure. You know, there's all these things that they don't allow us to have control over in the law.
We can't say that the house can't, the ADU can't be 4 stories tall.
Unless it's circumstantial. You want to talk about that? Because...
Well, the kind of the main theme in that bill was that you can't regulate the ADU any more strictly than you would the type of principal residence.
Oh, that's okay.
So if you have I have a two-story home.
Okay.
If I was ever part of a law system and then the ADU could be the equivalent height of my two-story home.
Well, I really appreciate the legislature leaving local land use decisions up to the residents that live in a community. I feel like that was particularly thoughtful of them.
I think they did hear that perspective from some of the associations when they were deliberating in Olympia.
Yeah. I mean, this takes our community's ability to say this is what we want to look like and this isn't what we want to look like. It kind of strips that from them. So you can have a home and you can have a duplex on your property is what the state has said.
And they also said that you could not require owner-occupied.
I don't know.
Is that can my ADU be bigger than my primary residence?
Well, it can't be less than, I think it's 1,200 square feet is what we said. Yeah.
So probably that's
depends on the size.
You put them together.
Yeah. Okay. But I think, too, just like we're experiencing here in Island County, there is a need for increased housing supply and affordability. And that is, this is one of the ways through that HAP tool that we can respond to the deficit that was in that table that John showed us earlier.
I think we were just trying to do that in a way that was still in alignment with our culture, aesthetic values, right? And so it wasn't that we are not trying to find creative housing solutions, but then I think part of our goal was that they would be in visual alignment with how we see ourselves. And this kind of changes that ability to control that a little bit more than I was anticipating.
It's true.
Janet?
It doubles down for me. I'm going to make up my own language rules here. Because you cannot require these to be owner-occupied, I am now ever more convinced we need to regulate Airbnbs. Because sure. Otherwise, it will not meet the goal of affordable housing for our community.
Absolutely.
I think we've covered the points on the slide. The last row, they're ready to go on.
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
One more. May not impose setback requirements, yard coverage limits, or aesthetic requirements. We have setback requirements on primary residences. Is it setback like it has to be within 100 feet of the home, like where we said that, or does it mean setback from the property line? Because we have that for...
It's different from what applies to the principal unit. So we could still have a lot of those development standards that you're pointing to. They just can't be more strict for the ADU than they would be for the home.
All right. Yeah. So it can't be, but the existing regulation. So if you're in the shoreline, it's not like the ADU circumvent the shoreline record.
Yeah,
Okay.
I think if that's in the point of clarification, I think the word that would have helped me was may not impose additional setback requirements, yard coverage limits, or aesthetic requirements.
Yeah, because I'm seeing people putting ADUs, abutting their neighbor's fence.
That's just clarifying for my brain. Okay. On
if an HOA has rules, so I live in an HOA, are those thrown out the window by this law, or do the HOA still allow, are they still allowed to set CRNRs around ADUs?
I understand that the county doesn't administer or enforce HOA rules, and so right. This is what we would use for permitting mm-hmm. purposes.
So if my next door neighbor wanted to put an ADU in her backyard, and I know that's not allowed by my HOA, my recourse would be to go to my HOA and say, they can't do this, it's against our CRNRs, and the state would not be able to stop that.
I think that would be a civil matter that you have to pursue in court.
Yes, but the
state would.
But the HOAs are still allowed to set standards for HOAs.
This is a good one, Mike. Now, if we're granting a building permit, do we look at those covenant requirements to say no? We're getting a head shaking no from everybody who does the enforcement, knows the rules. So we would grant a permit for something that a homeowners association does not allow. We don't review that and say, I'm sorry, we can't permit this in this area.
We yellow card it, and then the HOA has to respond.
No, I understand it. It's civil if the HOA wants to enforce their rules on one of their HOA members. I get that part. I'm asking if in Janet's neighborhood, this woman walks in and says, I want to put a duplex in my backyard mm-hmm. and I can support that on the septic.
So that's where it would be caught, is the water availability right. and septic. The HOA would catch it at that point. We've had a number of these cases where okay. someone comes in and wants to turn in for an ADU or an additional dwelling unit, and it's caught at that water system review, water availability review, that the HOA then would not approve that. They wouldn't be coming then to get a building permit from us.
Even if there is water availability, the HOA would still object at that moment, and we would take that objection
correct.
As a no.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay, so we do have a mechanism.
There's a mechanism with the water bill. Yeah.
We live in the world where everybody's going to come to us and ask these questions, so apologize that we ask really nitty-gritty, but that's what happens.
Can you cover the last bullet? Slide real quick, so that's important.
It's the condominiumization of these units.
And you're right that the bill mainly covers UGAs, but they threw some things in that are also pervasive across the county in this last one.
Right, and that's
is across the county.
That begs questions that I can't answer, which is, in order to condominiumize a lot in our unincorporated areas, it's going to require boundary lot adjustments, right?
But this is a UGA, though.
No.
No, they would record something with the auditor's office, that condominium plat, but we don't review that. We don't, that doesn't change their boundary lines.
So it doesn't change. They still don't own, basically they don't own the underlying land correct. That the condo sits on.
Yeah.
They just are selling what's on top of the land.
That's correct.
And the land remains part of whatever that condominium agreement that was established. Okay. I understand better.
Okay. So a question to my colleagues. After we talk about the comp plan, then we're going to talk about permit fees, I think, is the next thing. So which is going to be a good conversation as well. If we are you busy at 1:30, if we needed to come back at 1:30 to continue the conversation with planning?
I'm not.
Otherwise, I need to squeeze this, all of this stuff in the next hour and 20 minutes.
The first part. I can, but... an agenda card.
What do you
first part of that?
When can you come back, Jill, or can you?
I'm good until 3, I think.
Oh, okay. So we could come if we need to come back at 1:30 for permit fees. We can do that.
I'm checking on my.
Yeah, schedule. I'll ask Jen to cover. I know she's going to be there anyway, so she can just brief me on anything I miss in the meeting.
Okay. Supposed to be. I just wanted to make sure that if we need to rush through this, we rush through.
I wanted to be in it, but it's fine. We can make it work.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm good till 3.
Okay. Great. Continue.
Right. So now we're switching gears to a different state law that is more related to the HAT tool and the need for jurisdictions to address the housing needs of people at different income strata. They recognize at the Department of Commerce that one of the key ways to serve people in that 50 to 80% of median income for the area is with an ADU. And from that table that John showed earlier, we have a deficit of about 239 units in that strata of affordability. And so the thought here is that we could address that need outside of the UGAs in the rural areas and the zones that are listed here in the second arrow by having an ADU that would be offered as a rental unit that's affordable to people in that up to 80% income level. It would be something that would apply to that unit for a relatively short period, 3 to 5 years. And then this was an idea that came out of a planning commission blue sky session, I guess you could call it, where currently in this part of the county, we have a limit of 35 permits per year for ADUs. We would allow an additional 25 on top of that if they met this affordability requirement to serve this particular need, as pointed out by the state.
So to clarify, I could put up an ADU on my little property next to my house, and I could rent it out as an affordable property for 5 years. And after that, I could Airbnb it for, I'm on a lake, Airbnb it for $2,000 a night during August. Is that correct?
That's correct. Or anything else that's legally allowed to be done sure. with that structure, right?
Okay.
And during the 5 years, how do we know the incomes of the people in there, if they qualify, if they get a raise and they're no longer qualified? How are we evicting them? Because obviously we can't get them out. So we just learned that from the RV conversation. So how is this enforceable, these 25 additional units enforceable?
There are some other jurisdictions in the country and in the state who have, used mechanisms like this to administer and enforce these types of requirements. There would be different tools that we could use at different stages in the process. So at permitting, we would require something to be recorded either at the clerk's office or with the title that would acknowledge that these conditions apply and has to be offered as a rental and at this income level for this period of time. So that takes care of the permit step in the process. There are tools that other jurisdictions use that would sort of be an advertisement for the tenant so that they could have to sign an acknowledgement up front that they might have to seek another place to live if they exceeded the income level. So they would be made aware of that before they entered into the lease agreement. There also are tools available for the owner who could put provisions in the lease that would also make it clear that there are terms that either they might have to go through an eviction process or they might have to see an increase in the rent if they didn't meet the income levels. The way that some of these jurisdictions keep track of the income levels of the tenants is to require an income report, and it could come either from the tenant themselves or the landlord.
Verification.
Yeah. And you wouldn't have to necessarily, as a policy matter, evict them immediately upon, their promotion or raise. You could make provisions for them to stay for an interim period, or since we're talking about a term that's a maximum of 5 years, we could make some policy decisions about what the best course of action would be if someone exceeded the 80% level.
And requiring a disclosure in any transaction.
Right.
We've talked about this. I'm going to be on the losing side of this too. I feel like this is feel good language and not real language. To me, what we're saying is, I think it would be cleaner to just say, we'll increase it 25 units a year up to 60 units. They have to be primary residents. That seems an easier way to regulate and not set the amount of rent that's being charged or the income of the people who are being in it. First of all, I get phenomenally uncomfortable with the concept that we would go out there and code force on who's in a building, because I think our job is to stay out of the who and focus on the what a little bit. So I get nervous about that because I've taken all those courses on how government has structurally misalign some populations of people. So I don't like it when planning or land use involves who. I like it to focus on what. And if the what is that we need more ADUs in order to provide more inventory for people to rent as their primary residence, that keeps it from becoming VRBOs, or that seems a lot cleaner to me. Also, this idea that we can build more, but they have to be used for this income, but then they age out of that income category after 5 years. That's just 5 years is fast. And that is basically just saying you can build it, right? So you have 5 years of some potential stability for folks, and then they can just go on the free market. And I'm not sure that we're not just saying change it to 60. Yeah.
Becomes the next board's problem.
And so I feel like it's a way to make us feel good about what we're, it's how I felt about the Nichols conversation, right? Where we're like, well, it's for employers. No, it's theoretically it's for employers, but really it's just densities allowed in these areas. And this is basically where we're allowed, we would say we want 60, we could allow up to 60 ADUs a year. And we're going to try to create a bureaucracy that will keep it for its intended use. But the income part is what makes me a little uncomfortable. Saying it has to be rented is, or for primary housing, feels safer to me. I mean, I understand why we are doing this. This is trying to meet that specific housing need so we can show the numbers.
So one of the things that you said there, Jill, is that I want to follow through a little bit more. Is 60 ADUs a year that are primary residents. So even the 35 that we currently allow, we would be saying these need to be for primary residents. Because that's not the rule now, correct?
We don't regulate short-term.
We don't regulate them at all. People can just go and they could just turn them into short-term rental. So that's a really interesting
idea. I feel like the ADU thing should... But then again, I've made an argument before too, that that's how a lot of people afford their primary house, is by renting their ADU on the... So here's my other problem. I read a book. I know this is what happens when I get new knowledge that I don't fully understand always, but it basically says the issue with housing is a supply and demand. Housing affordability is a supply problem. And so all of these things we're trying to do to say, well, we're going to provide more housing, but it only needs to be for this income or only for this income. In reality, more supply creates affordability just by the fact that people can enter in at the housing market at what they can afford, right? So all these things we're trying to do to say, we're going to create more inventory, but it has to be for this. We're just creating more inventory. We're looking for ways to create more inventory. And I feel like that's pure planning also. And all of this additional social engineering that's trying to happen is dangerous, first of all, because again, it's a little those people-ish for me. Those people can live here and those people can live here, but we're anti-redliners. We don't believe in that. Well, we're doing the same thing. We're just using different words. To be clear, this is governmental social engineering. So it seems like the thing to do is just to say, we need to increase our inventory. Here's how we're going to do it. And then trust the process to work out that, you know, at a certain point, someone's not going to be able to rent for $2,000 a month because you've run out of people who can rent at that price point. And you're going to have to rent at $1,500. And then you're going to run out at that price point and you're still going to have inventory and you're going to rent it, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what happens when you have enough inventory. This is about inventory creation. It just is. And I appreciate that it doesn't have the feel good words that make us feel good. But I just feel like it's truthful. We're trying to create more inventory. So why are we putting words on it?
So your thoughts?
Yeah. So I understand the supply and demand conversation was one that I had wondered about for a long time. That is one point of view that I've heard often. There's also a lot of research that shows supply and demand does not reach affordability targets, that the market moves towards higher income homes. There's studies by the Urban Institute and others. So I'm not a supply and demand believer, because it hasn't worked for us in the last 10 years. I have read economists' articles. That's what the Urban Institute is. So, so I'm not a believer that that's going to solve the problem. I think it is a partial part of the solution, but I also think that we need to have a little bit of oomph around. We want inventory of housing in the AMIs that we're being told we have to accommodate. I'm a little confused by this, so if I could get some clarifying questions on this. And this is different than 1337, which mandated all this stuff we have to do. This is House Bill 1220 says we can allow a second ADU. Is that true?
This isn't second ADUs. This is because we have a limit in our rural zone right now. We're saying we're going to allow more if they're income restricted.
Okay. So I just want to understand what we're obligated to do as agents of the state. Are we obligated to allow more?
No.
Okay. That's the first clarifying thing I needed to get to. So we're talking about increasing the number from 25, which I honestly thought was sort of a 35 that I honestly thought was sort of a pilot. Let's try this and see how it works. So I'm fine with increasing. Not sure somebody made the comment of, do we increase it all at once? Do we go to 45 in 2026, 55, and then to 60? Do we then cap it at 60, or do we continue to increase that? We haven't answered those questions, right? We don't have to go straight to adding that much.
Is a proposal.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, we can do.
And then is it capped at 60? Do we cap it at 60 to the board, or do we just say we're going to increase up to 60 and then reevaluate again? That's a question. And we are saying that we will allow these changes in our rural forest and commercial ag zones. And I'm actually supportive of that, because I think with commercial ag, it allows workforce housing, right?
That was the idea.
Or in rural forest, it adds workforce housing. So I just needed to get clear on what we are obligated to do and what we're optioning into.
Thank you. So my view is, I think it would be a lot cleaner if we did 60 per year, and it's the intention of this, of ADUs, is for residents. The intention, so it's a philosophical statement we'd be making. We can go back to this conversation when we talk about short-term rentals. But I think that at this point, our concern is not where tourists can go. At this point, our concern is where residents can live. And so I think that I would support 60 ADUs per year for residential living. So you have to be there for at least whatever, 6 months or however we end up defining that sort of thing when we talk about short-term rental.
Under your consideration, we're just grandfathering what already happened.
I wouldn't.
I'm not saying I would. I'm asking Commissioner what you're recommending.
Well, I think that if, going back to what you raised earlier, Commissioner, there are people who are able to live here now because they have their home, and then they have their ADU that they rent out short to rental, and that's how they survive. Uh-huh. I would not want to go back and say, sorry, you have to change your whole way of doing this. I would have a concern about that. Do you disagree with that?
No, I don't either. I agree with that.
I mean, I think part of also, one, I don't like the regulating the who, right? The other thing the other part is that how many years have we hit our 35 ADU limit?
There's only been a couple of years. Right now in September, we've issued 20 ADU permits. So
I was thinking last year, I thought we hit 35 in June or something.
Well, we got very close and maybe got to it at the end of the year, but
okay.
Yeah, there's been a couple of years where they get used up pretty fast.
During COVID.
Yeah.
And then would the first 35 we allowed in be it? I mean, this, I'm still trying to, because mm-hmm. I know we're going to hear from the Planning Commission. So So the first 35 we allow in can be for VRBOs, and it could be for any income level. And then the 36 would have to do the affordable housing.
It's a board decision.
The idea was people would choose a route they go, right? So if you want to do a market rate ADU, you apply for the 35. The assumption is there's people out there who want to do this long-term rental thing with ADUs and provide that type of housing. So they would go straight to, it's not like a lottery system where we'd force them into the long-term.
Right. But if we're not using the existing 35 regularly now, you could do what they want to do under the existing 35. It's not like you have to limit yourself to, right. So that's where I'm like, I don't know. I'm not totally seeing how it completely makes sense. This isn't going to incentivize more people to limit the amount that they can charge or something that they're going to build that's going to cost as much if they build it for affordability or market rate, right? It's still going to cost them $250,000 to build this ADU, whether they rent it for $500 a month or $2,500 a month.
Unless our permits are cheaper if you're doing this.
Okay, maybe the permits.
That's a really interesting incentive.
How much is that? $20,000 off?
Well, look at the permit fees.
So, I mean, I think... Okay, I think just increasing the inventory, because the other thing that happens on a supply and demand curve that seems to be lost in some people's minds is that when you build something new, it's higher end and higher income. But what happens is the older inventory becomes less desired, and then other people enter into that, right? There are neighborhoods that I know in Oak Harbor that are charging $500,000 to buy a home. That is, those homes are worth $250,000, $300,000. Those homes should be worth $250,000 and $300,000, and they would be if the people who could afford $500,000 homes had options to buy those. So yes, it's true that new construction drives up costs or doesn't come in at an affordable level. It's not intended to. What it's intended to do is free up capacity of older homes that don't inflate at that same rate and that people can afford or that people can rent affordably. I mean, so anyway, I think that it's fine if we want to go to 60. I think we have to work on our justification, which is that we believe that, and I also think regulating it for ADUs, for future ADUs, that are used for permanent housing is the way to go. It's just, again, we're still gonna have to have a tracking mechanism.
Yes.
Because we don't, you know, I guess if someone was using it as a VRBO, we'd send somebody out there and say, you can't do that. But partly, if we don't have a way to enforce and implement the ideas, then we just need to call it and say, we're creating it more inventory, here's your permit, and we're done.
So can I tell you a little bit more about why, at least from a staff perspective, we felt like this was an idea worth pursuing?
Yeah,
sure.
So the House Bill 1220 requires us to demonstrate that we have capacity at these income levels to have our comp plan approved. So with all the solutions we're proposing, we're looking at our land capacity analysis. We're looking at what income level we think this will qualify for, and trying to demonstrate that we're going to meet those numbers. There are some really interesting cases that came out of the Growth Management Hearing Board this week that are challenging House Bill 1220 decisions for the very first comp plans that were subject to it. And this is the issue. Demonstrating capacity sufficiently is the issue. And two jurisdictions have already lost because they didn't do that sufficiently. The Growth Management Hearing Board has said rezoning and saying you have capacity when the land value is too high and you're never going to meet that income level isn't enough.
I would think, though, Emily, maybe I'm wrong, but if we said 60 ADUs per year, I think that we would be pretty, I think it's pretty obvious, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's pretty obvious that the people who are going to be moving into an ADU are probably not the people who are at 120% or above AMI. It's probably going to be people below 120% AMI. So I think you could use your percentage calculations and stick it onto that 60 ADUs per year, and then identify how many of those would be the 50 to 80%, the same percentage that you already had. Because now we're talking 60, we're not talking 25, we're talking all 60 being used as housing, as residential housing.
That's fair. You know, the state guidance says that ADUs can be counted at 80% and above. We were trying to get a mechanism to count it lower. And if somebody signed an affidavit saying, I'm going to rent it below 80%, that was our mechanism
for
counting it, to say, here we have these ones that are available below 80%. And that's how we were trying to create that capacity with a regulated system. And I get that it's an administrative burden, and there is going to be a lot of questions about how we hold people accountable to that. But that was part of the tool in the toolbox we were using to demonstrate this capacity and get to the numbers that we need to get to.
So well, I think the best way that I think that we're going to be able to do that is going to be to find some way in permitting that we could give some kind of incentive to people
to do
affordable housing.
Okay. I can support this. We have to go back and clarify to your all 60 versus all the additional ones.
Yeah.
Right? Because if all 60 must be housing, are we eliminating in the future any ability to be an owner-occupied ADU? You understand my question? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's just a question the board will have to struggle with, but we're going to have to circle back on that question, because I think none of us want to take away someone whose retirement has, you know, like been outstripped by inflation, and they're choosing that, you know, renting an ADU above the garage or however they've done it, attached or detached, as a way to supplement their income to stay in their own home. I don't want to take that away. But where I have Airbnb or some of these big companies going in and buying a parcel, renting out the main parcel, building two ADUs, that is not my,
not what we
want. That's not my constituent. That's not my goal.
Okay.
Should we move on? I lost track of how many more slides we have. Maybe about
half about 100.
I was going to say half a dozen.
We're at co-living.
Okay.
Co-living. Are any of these easy?
So this sounds a lot like things that people already do in the county, I would think, but also it's different. And we didn't specify the bill that directed this, but this also is a state mandate that we recognize explicitly that this is a housing type that's an option.
Yeah.
In our jurisdiction. And so it's defined in the bold statement that's here. It's a residential development could look like a house or a multifamily development. You're renting the sleeping units, they're called, the rooms, as the what would otherwise maybe be thought of as a like a studio apartment. They're lockable. And then there's common shared spaces like kitchens and sometimes bathrooms in the building that all of the sleeping room tenants have access to. And so that's, I don't know if I made that explanation shorter than the bold statement there, but that was my plain spoken attempt.
Are these any of these not, is this not allowed in any way in any of these zones?
I don't think we've had clear.
Well, you know, they're
in Langley.
I have a house that with a little room downstairs. I mean, can't I just rent that out right today?
Yep.
You could. And this isn't something, it's another option. It's an arrow in the quiver.
Boarding house model.
Yeah.
It's a boarding house, single room occupancy, they used to be called. Some people think of them that way. In this model, as they've been built in other jurisdictions in the Sound, the homeowner doesn't live in it, and they're not renting out their rooms. They rent the whole thing.
Oh, they rent all the rooms
separately. Oh, okay.
Interesting.
So it's similar but different.
Yeah. I always heard this as the boarding house model. That's how my brain interpreted it. But in the boarding house model in the olden days, I lived there. So what widows did to support themselves sometimes, remember? Mm-hmm.
So
don't want to. Okay.
That's what it is. It would just be another option, a housing type that would be allowed. It would be in the non-municipal urban growth areas and that list of zones that's in the first arrow. In that zone, if it's single family homes that are allowed, then we would use the standards for single family homes, and that's what they would look like from the outside. And then in the zone, a multifamily development is allowed, then they could use those standards. So that's the basics of it.
So my only concern with this is that, you know, down in my district, there are people who are, this is a big deal for them. They're really pushing for it and they think it's wonderful. And they're trying to talk everyone into doing it, which is great. Once the government starts putting in codes associated with it, how far down that rabbit hole do we go? I mean, do we start then saying, well, you have to have the bathroom for no more than two people? Or I mean, how you know?
Can we go to the next slide? There's a list of the standards that we have to have that came from the state.
The state has standards.
Yeah, and so it's in some cases protective of the housing type, and in some cases it just helps you to make it be a good neighbor. And so each of the sleeping units would count as a quarter of a dwelling unit where we have density limits. The same standard would apply for parking units. So it would be one space for every four sleeping units. There's a sewer connection fee would be applied at half a dwelling unit. We're able to protect water quality and see to proper sewage disposal. We would want to see building permits so that we could have the official record of what's there, and we can check the standards, and then life and fire health safety.
So I can't just rent out my room and say I have to go get permission from my government to do it.
No, you could do that. It wouldn't be a co-living housing. If you wanted to have a co-living housing development, then this would be the pathway to do it. If you wanted to live in a house and rent your rooms out, and that's allowed, you could do that. This is kind of the same thing that the planning commissioners sort of quizzed us on as we presented this to them last week. It's like, well, I'm not sure I see how that would be any different and why anybody would do this. And that could be.
So maybe it's I want to build one of these and I need to go to the bank and I need to have a thing that I'm calling this and this is what I'm calling it.
Right.
So it's sort of like I'm building an apartment complex, but I don't have to put kitchens in every single room. I just put in one kitchen and everybody has to share it.
It's like those pod units. Podments?
Yeah, they're called the podments or micro housing in the other jurisdictions in Seattle. Okay.
And then how often do we go in and make sure that they've got the right number of people in the dwelling unit for the septic system? And how often do we go in and make sure that their smoke alarms are in place? How often are we doing that inside this structure?
Same as we would do for any other type of housing.
So not at all.
Unless we got a complaint.
Unless complaint driven. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
What's the income?
Well, that's not regulated, but one of the things that has made this an attractive thing to build in other communities is that on a per square foot basis, it's higher than what you would earn in a standard apartment. But if you're looking at it from the perspective of somebody that can only afford so much a month, it can be quite affordable.
Because they don't have to, the builder doesn't have to put in a kitchen in every single.
Yeah, there's less infrastructure.
But we don't have to do anything that regulates the creation of these to associated income levels. We're just going to assume that people would live in this if their income didn't allow them to live on their own. So we're going to be assumptive here, but we weren't assumptive on the ADUs.
That's true. That's the proposal. I mean, we could, if as a policy matter, you wanted to have an income restriction on here, we could look at that.
No, I don't. I don't want it on either. Mm-hmm.
But if you make more money, you probably are not going to want to be in this kind of situation.
I think the difference is the state's guidance on this one versus the other one.
Yeah.
I know what I'm struggling with right now is not your ideas. What I'm struggling with is taking my own advice, which is just put the damn plan on paper, check the box, and move on. It's not real. Who cares? That is competing with my self-commitment that I made to not participate in things that I recognize for what they are, which is like social engineering, structural racism. I really learned about that. I literally learned about it because I didn't believe it could be true. And I learned how it was true. And now I'm participating in it. And I want to throw up because I made a commitment to myself that I wasn't going to do this. And the state is requiring us to do it. And they put a bunch of feel-good words on it, so we feel good about it. So, it is absolutely wrong. This is going into private property and saying this person can live here and this person can live here. This is social engineering, and social engineering is systemic racism. That's what that is. We learned about it. Do we need to choke a guy for another 7.5 minutes for us to talk about it again? We learned this lesson.
Jill, I genuinely don't see how this
the whole
fits
thing
into
is,
that.
The whole thing is, when we say this income can live this way, and we formalize it as government, that is what that is. That is this room right now. Show me who in this room who's Black. Show me in this room who's poor. Show me in this room who is anything other than suffering from saviorism, trying to make sure that those people who have less than us have places to live.
You know what I like about this? It means that people who right now are living in an RV with their sewage going down into a wetland, this might be more affordable and safer for those individuals.
But this exists right now. You could, I could rent out my room right now.
Right, but we're not talking about that. This, from what I just heard, is talking about, I want to build a house that's got a kitchen in it, and it's got four different little compartments, and people share the kitchen, and that's cheaper living. It's going to cost less for those people to live there than it would if every unit had to have their own living room and their own kitchen and all of their other amenities.
Right, but we don't disallow that now, is what I'm saying. The market could do that right now. Somebody could go in and buy a house in my neighborhood and do that right now. We don't prohibit it. This is just putting down on a plan that's like, we're gonna tell the state where we're gonna put those people. And I get that it's just a plan, and I get that it's just math. I also get that it's fundamentally wrong and we don't have a choice. I get that too. But that's where I'm falling apart in this conversation. And I don't understand why I'm the only one falling apart in this conversation. This is saying those people can live this way, but those options exist now and they're not working for people.
No one's building this. I've never seen anyone build this.
It's a house. This is a house. This is all this is a house.
It's a house that was intended to not have a owner occupy it. This is a house that was intended to be rented, rooms rented to somebody, to people.
So I don't think Jill's wrong. When I first started teaching and I was living on a pretty limited income, I rented a house and I had my room and then we had three roommates. So we each had our own unit, mm-hmm. and we shared the common space. So that's how I was able to afford a place to live when I first started out, right? And so I think that's what I hear Commissioner Johnson saying is that exists. And I agree with her, that exists. This is perhaps in theory a way to expand that market to people who had never thought of it as a marketplace before. It's an additive, but I do agree with Commissioner Johnson that it already exists because that's how I lived when I was making $15,000 a year teaching school.
Commissioner Johnson, to address your points, I would say staff has heard your points, and I would say that all of our attempts to like kind of shoehorn all of this affordable housing out into the county is an attempt to fight back against just putting all the affordable housing in the city, make everyone who doesn't have enough money just live in the city. So we're working where we can to push against that and make more available opportunities in the rural areas as well.
And this would be allowed in all zones practically. I think your list was pretty encompassing. Co-living housing would be all of our zoning categories.
It's not the ideas that you're bringing forward. It's the philosophy behind it that I feel like we government missed the whole point on. And there is a striking difference between my ability to read the ideas and the realization that I'm going to have to put my name on a document that's going to do something that I foundationally don't agree with. And that sucks. And there's nothing you can do about it. You can't yell about it. You can't change it. You can't fix it. You're just going to do it. And it sucks. And I don't like it anymore. Okay, keep going. RVs.
RVs, yeah. John's going to do this.
Right. Temporary RVs. The hot topic today. Okay, so Right now, if you are building a brand new house, you can live in an RV for a while you're building that house. Nobody else, though. So hearing the board,
good.
I know. So hearing the board's input on that's kind of unfair, right? We've looked at ways that we could allow for more people to temporarily live in an RV, whether they're just moving here or they've lost a job or for any other number of reasons, somebody could live in an RV on private property for up to a year. They are going to need all the stuff figured out, though. They're going to need water, their septic, electrical, life safety. We want to make sure that that's an okay situation. It's not just like some of the unpermitted situations where this is happening are very unsafe. So we want to make sure that's
not even fully operating RVs in some of those cases.
Yes. So we want to make sure that is not the case. We want people to be safe. So we need to have some rules for that. We want
to. Does it when you don't move, Michael?
Yeah. We just
like snoring.
There you go.
We want to allow people to live up to a year in an RV on private property. And we would like to allow for extensions if they're working with our housing folks to secure permanent housing. We'd be able to allow that to continue. Commissioner St. Clair. Yeah.
So I have questions about our definition of an RV because we have all of these new mobile, non-mobile, tiny home, you know, all of these new definitions that have emerged in recent years. How are we defining an RV? Is it on wheels? Is it able to be moved? Or do any of the tiny home modular homes apply? That's my question.
It's a great question. So right now we define it as pretty much something on wheels, an RV, a camper trailer, a fifth wheel, those types of units.
Park model.
Park model, yeah, park model. So those are all like RVs. Looking at a tiny house, if the tiny house is still on wheels,
yes,
the tiny house could possibly be considered an RV. We could make our definition reflect
that. And if it's a tiny house that's stick built, not on wheels, then it applies as an ADU.
Yes.
It has a box.
Yes.
The place you can put any subject all the water and safety. But the ones you see creatively built that are, you know, trailers, basically on trailer built, we're going to find an RV so that it can be moved off if needed. And the reason I think about that is the ability to, 1 year with extensions allowed, make sure, I want to make it, if it meets standard, it becomes a safety hazard, something easier to be moved off. That's why I'm wheels. Should we use to implement that be under model under the ADU policies? Does that make sense to you?
It makes perfect sense, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, great. We're subject to type. And then as long as they cease using it as residence at the end of that year, if they do the extension, that's kind of how we would.
And it's just parked in the yard.
Story, I'm not going to prevent that anything here without.
Does you have another RV?
So we have both RV on private property and then have a pilot RV parking lot program, which Michael talked about here.
And just to clarify that the temporary RVs on single family lots are only with an existing residence.
Thank you.
The way we marked up the code.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think so. That's what I remember just talking about. It was changing that sort of unfair thing about the 3 month if you're building or remodeling.
So what I would want is, however we design the code associated with this, we talked earlier this morning about a home where there's a private home and then there's six RVs parked on that private home. And they've been there for 10 years or something is what we were told. And there's all sorts of failing everything and the homeowners want them out, but they can't get them out because they've been living there for all these years and commissioners kind of, we all freaked out about that because they're not allowed anyway. So what I would want is that these codes be written in such a way, because that situation kind of sits there. It kind of sits there. And I would want the codes to be written in such a way as to make it easier for the county, for the homeowner, to get those RVs off that property once that 1 year came up and or the RV was not complying with the requirements for septic or water or so on. So I would want to tighten our ability to respond to violations of this. What we're trying to be is generous and allow people to have more availability for housing, but we don't want to make it just a free for all, even worse than the situation that we have today.
We hear that. We'll work with the prosecuting attorney's office on this code language and make sure there's some provisions in there.
And then I think no more than two per home.
Thank you.
Because that's the ADU limit.
Yeah, that's right. That's the ADU.
That's a consonant.
And so, I mean, I don't know if that is variable based on the acreage, but I feel like there needs to be some type of limit.
I agree.
The other part is if you have a bedroom affidavit, you don't get to do this because you've already oversized your home for your septic. So you don't have, or not, that's an out, I think. So on all of these, all of them, I think we should talk about not having them in airport zones. So I think the ADUs, even the 60, you don't get ADUs in the airport.
Do you mean AQs? APZ too.
APZs district. First and foremost, but even the private airports, yeah. I would say when we drop those overlays in, that these, okay, none of these densifying and solutions should go in those areas.
Okay.
I don't know if I'd go as far as the full AQs because that's half the island, but
okay.
But definitely the APZ.
Definitely the APZ. I would say
these solutions are out in those.
Okay. I think that's a great catch.
It is a great catch.
And I'm fine with that, even those private airports where we haven't flushed out all of those maps and stuff, but I don't, what got me was the park model homes. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, they're going to be in those areas, they're just not designed for that experience. And so then that got me thinking, maybe this is, even the densification of the things is probably, this isn't, those aren't the zones for it.
When you say they're not designed, are you talking about the mitigation against noise? And
mostly it's the sound, but it's just, I also just think it's,
that's a good catch. A really good catch.
We just don't want to densify those areas unnecessarily.
Yeah, I think that's a good catch. Yeah, I think that's a good catch. I also think that if you've already got the affidavit for additionals, we can't, I mean, it's going to always be septic and water anyway. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Good. All right, one last RV related proposal. So this one is,
give you all the bad ones. Just to be clear, I don't know if you were feeling like included and you're like, oh, yay. But just, you got to toughen up back there and be like, no, Lanier, you can bring some things to the table.
Well, low guy in the totem pole is the position.
John was like,
it's not intentional.
You're super experienced and you have all this great knowledge. We're going to let you do this one.
Yeah.
All right, new guy. RV safe spot. Safe program. Here we go.
Look, do I have an idea for you?
Shoot.
This was actually in a memo that predated my time here, but here we go. So it's a transitional housing choice, something that would help us deal with some of the stuff we were talking about earlier today, as you previewed for us, that would apply in a variety of the residential zones in the rural areas and in the what are now called RAIDs. They're a 1 year term limited housing or shelter choice. The idea is it would be a pilot program. We would permit one on each of the islands and observe how they work, and then make recommendations to the board about any ideas about how it might be improved or whether or not we should go forward with more of them. It would be an operation that's owned or managed by a government, religious, or nonprofit group. They would offer support services, career and lifestyle and drug and alcohol counseling, potentially, by a licensed provider. They would, like I said, operate for a year. They'd be limited to 20 RVs, and then each of the RVs individually could be on the safe lot for a maximum of 90 days. They'd be subject to our type 1 temporary use approval, and then it would have some standards related to dealing with the sewage and also some screening and setbacks to help them be as good a neighbors as they could be. I think that's it on this
one. Can you talk to the may operate for up to 1 year? Because I don't know that I would want to go to all of this effort to create something like this and then only be able to be in business for 1 year.
When we were talking with the Planning Commission last week, some of the commissioners did express that same sentiment. They thought both the 1 year term limit might be a little too short, and also that maybe we should allow people to be there for 6 months rather than the 90-day limit. Or, you know, so some further consideration and thinking on the mm-hmm. on both of those term limits, I think, are in order for us.
Okay. Yeah, so the 1 year we were thinking we want to get, you know, an example of one of these up and running on Whidbey and Camino and see how it works. We're totally flexible on whether 1 year is enough of a time period to understand if this is a good model for us to continue or not.
How, I'm trying to, how does it work for, like, what's the septic situation? Are they supposed to drive out and dump, or are we putting in?
They're going to have to propose a septic solution that is acceptable.
The government, religious group, or nonprofit yes. that operates.
That's citing it.
I mean, that's going to be the cost prohibitive part, unless it's pump, pump at wherever your pumping station is.
Yes.
And so, I mean, I kind of agree that if you're going to put in that much infrastructure, yeah. you've got to be able to justify that. But I also agree that we don't know how this is going to work, because, I mean, part of, now here I'm going to go the other way from my last tier-a-thon, is part of what's frustrating is to, like, create an RV safe lot, which is kind of a suspension of rules and codes. And then we require people to follow rules and codes in other scenarios. And so we would be breaking our own rules a little bit, right? Because we're not going to require people to, I mean, if we don't let people have porta potties at their house, for example.
Well, we permit RV campgrounds, if that makes you more comfortable, under similar standards and similar densities.
So then how would this be different than that then?
It's specifically for temporary housing.
How long they can stay there.
And how long they can stay there. Well, RV campgrounds also have to move. I think this is
the There's a state law on that may address that 1 year thing, in that there's a state law that says if you live in an RV, you can only live there 50 weeks out of the year, whatever it is. And they have to, because I have a friend who lives in one of those in Snohomish, and she has to literally get up and move for 2 weeks out of the year. So she takes a big, you know, so that's a state law.
We can look at that.
So like an RV park, I imagine like the one as you're coming onto the island, there's an RV park that people stay there a long time. And
yeah.
This, glad to clarify this. This I thought was in response to like Hoffman Road, for example. Where it
came up.
And so we were going to fence out an area, and then we can move the people to the area. We'd have to have on-site services at that area. But that area, if it's Hoffman Road, they're not moving to that RV park. They're not moving to an area like that. They're just piling in there. And I don't know how they were bathing or showering or getting water. We were just getting them off the side of the road. So that's where I'm asking about some of these questions of like, I don't think we allow you to live in a house without running water and working septic. We don't let you just put up porta potties and say, well, you can just bring in potable water and make all that work. We don't really allow that. This would be allowing that. in some sense. Otherwise, it's the same standard as that RV park up by Deception Pass, and that's not what I thought this was. This was literally get off the side of the road, park here.
Well, but if we're setting up something, we still have to set it up in a safe way, you know, a public health kind of safe way. So we do have to, we would have to provide them with potable water. We would have to provide them with a place to dump their septage. We would have to provide them with electricity, and we would have to provide them with security.
Is that what this was about?
I think it would have to be that.
Yeah. Is that how Seattle does theirs, or they just say park here?
This was modeled after a Bellevue example that we found.
Do they have an RV problem in Bellevue?
No comment.
Okay.
But no, yeah, the idea is to provide services, make it safe, make it functional. Not just a free-for-all.
The government can't authorize something that is not, you know, safe. We just can't.
Well, right, but by the time you bring it up to those codes and those standards,
it's an RV park, isn't it?
Yeah. And then we're just paying for them to be there. The only difference is that we're paying their lot fees versus them paying their lot fees. So I
track where Jill's going, if that, and I know you said you changed your mind on this, but I track, which I'm trying to figure out. One, we saw other jurisdictions pilot strategies like this, and they ended up not being successful strategies. So, and they then curtailed some of those strategies and didn't do them anymore. So I'm worried about the safety. I'm worried about the things that we've been talking about for the last couple of days. But to Jill's point, if we're saying let's do a pilot to create a RV park that meets all of the RV rules and regulations for public safety, and then out of a separate strategy, we agree to waive the lot fee for someone to live in that lot for a while, I can go there. At first I was a no, not yet. This does not answer too many questions for me that I could say go forward with this at this point in time. I could go forward with a different strategy that says, can we help develop a place where the county agrees to waive a lot fee for a while and people, it's the public health and safety issue that I'm not convinced on with this strategy, as well thought out it is as it is.
There's going to be people with kids. It has to be a safe place if this is operated by the government.
Like a campsite?
Yeah, like a campsite, Jill. Yes. It has to be like the
where campsite. Where we could pay for people to have their lot fees paid for at a campsite.
I think it's like that.
It's possible. That's another conversation, but it is like that.
I mean, I guess, so it's not that I'm necessarily opposed to this. It's that I thought that this was different and that it was literally like a get off the side of the road temporary type of solution where we would get those RVs moved in there. We would try to get services around them. But it is a suspension. In my mind, it was a suspension of rules a little bit that they were using porta potties, we had hand washing stations and it was designed to say, okay, we've got human services in there. We're working with you. We're trying to figure out a more stable place for you to stay, or you've got to like move along, or like if somebody's coming through and their RV breaks down, well, that's fine, but you're not going to set up residency on the side of one of our roads because we don't allow, we're working on our code, I'm sure, that says we don't allow overnight stays on the side of the road anywhere. That's not what our roads are designed for. So I thought it was that, not like a campsite, but like a human service kind of fenced in area where we contained some of the behaviors and got eyes on the problem.
That is where the conversation came up because we had that emergency situation. But now we're looking at an actual part of our code. We're not looking at an emergency. Maybe emergency safe lot is a separate thing.
As a permanent.
So the way
that this is a permanent thing.
I mean, the way this is written is the code language that accompanies in the packet says support services must be provided on site by a licensed provider. Septic pumping and water connections must be available on site. So yeah, it's trying to outline that criteria to get the RVs off the street into a safe place for this temporary. That's what the 90-day provision was meant to be for, the health transition of the more stable and more stable situation. It was to serve that need that you're identifying. If it's not the right solution for that need, we're happy to hear your ideas and suggestions.
I just am not there yet. So, I mean, I'll go with the will of the board, but I'm not there yet. I have way too many questions and things I'd need to think through.
You know why I would prefer 60 days to, or excuse me, 6 months to 90 days is, as I'm thinking about all those cases we were looking at earlier today, people living in RVs. And our goal, I think one of our goals would be to get them out of the situations where they are in to at least here. And I think we'd be more likely to convince people to make that transition if they knew they had up to 6 months rather than the 90 days. 90 days is a little bit harsh. Yeah.
I just need to understand how it's different than RV parks. And then I also just need, again, these conversations kill me on the philosophical. That's where I get lost every time. But if there's any suspension of building code rules to do this, that is an acknowledgement that those are the kind of rules that are driving up the costs and prohibiting the creation of affordable housing. And if we're willing to suspend it for ourselves to solve problems, then that to me says these are some of the problems and we need to get those out of the way. If we have to create a fake environment in order to make something affordable, wouldn't that be the lesson that what we're doing is contributing to the problem we're having? That is where I'm losing my mind with government and why this is, I can't keep doing this. It's because it's just, let's create more rules to counteract the rules that we already put in place because those rules are creating this problem. So we're going to create this solution over here where we suspend the rules. I mean, you're all saying WTF in your heads, right? That doesn't make sense. So it's not that I don't think we need a solution like this. I think all communities probably need a solution. I think one per island is probably a fair solution. But I'm also, to me, the fact that we need this solution speaks to a larger problem, which is there's not a way to be poor. And we have a county park that we could let people stay in right now and pay their fees. We could do that for the off season and try it that way.
Maybe that becomes our first one.
It's an off season activity. Off season. I don't know.
Winter kind of thing.
Okay. All right. I'm not a no. I just don't totally get it yet. That's okay. Because you gave it to New Mike.
More conversation.
Thanks for hearing me out.
Okay. Thank you very much. Did you want to get started on the next topic, you guys? Or do you want to take a break? Jill, why don't you stand up and stretch your legs a little bit?
Absolutely. I'm boss, don't stand up.
Okay, we're back with planning, and we're going to start the conversation. We'll return if we need to, which we probably will. Permit fees.
So, Jonathan Lang, Island County Planning Director. We talked at our budget work session about a proposal to increase fees to address our budget deficit. We had initially talked about an increase of 50% from the current increase. In 2023, implemented in 2024, we increased land use and building fees. Prior to that, it had been a number of years, back in 2015, 2018, was the last time that fees were updated. So in the packet was a comparison fee schedule with proposed increases and comparisons to other jurisdictions. And we also just had talked to the board about an idea of coming back with fee update for
this year or beginning of 2026, and then a percentage fee update in 2027. And then after that, the resolution to update fees would address updating the fees per the CPI percentage amount each year. So that's what I have for you today. After discussions with the board, we did talk about, and I had given you all information about possibility of the of a 40% increase for 2026, and then a 20% increase in 2027 with a CPI increase after that. Are there any specific questions you might have or any thoughts?
Do you have anything?
Well, you and I went through this once before and you added more data since the first draft you gave us.
Yeah.
I still have questions on some of the suggested items where we appear to be well off what our comps are. A lot of them I'm fine with, you know, you've given the data that makes it more clear. But there's still places like, let me just grab one, the Long Platte approval. We is a fairly large jump. And I don't know why, but Skagit's at 426 and San Juan, and we don't have data. And I can never make sense of your Snohomish County data where it's, I don't have time to do the math on all of those, 2,400 plus or minus this, but as opposed to a flat fee. But and I get it, but I still have some questions on the ones where we appear to be a ways off the comps. Not that we have to do what everybody else does. Like my mom told me, you don't have to do, you know, just because your best friend says it that way. But I do still have, just want to be fair, you know, and not arbitrary. So those were the only ones I had. I don't have any questions about anyone in specific, and where the comps justified, I'm certainly ready to go forward on those. That's my only comments.
Okay. Jill?
Can you walk me through again? I'm sorry, but I don't have it with me. But you showed me a budget. If we do a 40% increase, what's the shortfall in the budget and how are we making that up? And that it's probably right in front of me and I'm not. Okay.
This was a document that I had.
Yeah, this was the one. This was the one. I'm getting in the rabbit on what are these permits, and that's really not what I need.
Yeah, fair.
I don't understand what the difference between 1 through 12. They all look like the same things to me. So I don't need to learn that today.
I think you should probably
should learn that 11 years ago. But what I do want to do is understand where our budget. So if we did the 40%.
Yeah, so in the with the 40%, we would be
$26,000 short.
Correct, in our fund balance. And the thought about increasing the fees to a certain percentage, at least 40%, would then over the course of the time add in back into that fund balance.
Right.
And no, with the 50%, that would definitely add into it. But yes, the fund balance with the fee increase was the, yeah.
And did the, sorry, and then on, did the, okay, the first section tells me it's a 40%. 15%, 3%. So, and then the next year, the next option is a 40% 2013. So the first two options are 40% this year. Then drop, I'm sorry to just be rudimentary. Then dropping down to a 35% increase, we've got basically everything in the red there. So we need to at least get to 40%. And then that just shows us that we don't have any fund, we're still using fund balance, mm-hmm. overusing fund balance, but that's the only thing we're overusing.
So can I understand what you just said? So with the first set, you're saying we have to get to 40% or we're just way underwater because of lack of having acted on this. And so we're at the first chunk, 40%, then 15%, and then the 3% CPI, which we've been building into these. The second one is 40% plus 20% plus the CPI. If in the first set that Jill was referencing, is that 2028, is that deficit that then starts to get created, will that grow then over time? So if that's the case, the only option is really the second option.
Yeah, that is correct. So when we first looked at, when we were looking at our budget and saw the budget shortfall, we looked back at what percentage we would need to increase it. And we were thinking of a one-time increase. And so we said, well, we have to increase it at least 43%. And so we decided to come before you and said the 50%. Well, these options show kind of an increase over 2 years. And yes, the second option is the one that gets us out of the red. And then we can build onto our fund balance with that CPI every year after that.
Okay.
And then does that second option include putting one of the critical areas planners on clean water utility or no?
So there were two, the clean water utility was not in this.
It's in there. Okay.
Built in this. So the clean water utility fund would add, and from what I was seeing with Sean's information, I think it was a $90,000 for 2026, and then possible increase after that. The other thing that we weren't really accounting for in this, a few weeks ago, we got notice from one of our permit techs that they took a job in another jurisdiction. So that is a position that if we hold on to, we would get that, where we were thinking of attrition of positions kind of down the road. Well, this is right now, we're going to be saving that.
Okay. Because there's a, you use the L word, which we're not using. It says layoff. And so.
Correct. Yeah.
That's a word that the board is working to avoid and not using.
Yeah.
But attrition is a word we're using. And then also, so with the clean water utility and the holding of the permit tech, there shouldn't be a need for a current expense transfer necessarily.
Into the fund.
We would still get current expense for the GMA and code enforcement, but not, right. We would not be using our fund balance.
Correct.
So with clean water utility, which is a fixed source of revenue that doesn't go up with increased cost over time, moving a position to clean water utility is something that helps us right now. And we'll just have to keep evaluating what that means in the future, because it's not growing with the needs.
Right. But that position, I don't know how it fell off of clean water.
Yeah, utility. I'm not disagreeing with you on it. I just am, it was the first time it kind of was my aha that's a fixed fund that doesn't have capacity to grow with the increased costs. Of course we grow with healthcare, inflation, all the other things.
Right. But I want to talk about a little bit, and we're not going to have time this morning to do it, but if we come back this afternoon, we could, is the fact that we're looking at this from our budget, and I want to look at it for a moment from the perspective of the people who would be paying the increased permit fees. And what we hear from the community is they think that we don't charge enough and they're happy to pay increased fees. But on the other hand, what they expect us to do with this increase in dollars is hire more people and pay them more money. And I'm not hearing hiring more people and paying them more money as part of this conversation.
No, but we're also not
So I think that that's what's going to make this a difficult sell with the community, is you're going to be getting the same level of service that you get right today, which for good or ill, you get the same level of service and you're going to be paying, 55% more, whatever it is, for that level of service.
I feel like McDonald's should have taught them that lesson by now, because I go there and pay 55% more and I'm pretty sure that my hamburger's bought. So I feel like that we've all just been learning that lesson all around us, that that's where we're at, is that the costs are going up, and it's for the same level of quality in our case. In other cases, the costs are going up and we're getting lower quality. And I think that the community is understanding that when we're in a robust time and we're asking people to pay more, that's when I think their expectations are going up. But you're going to be hard pressed to find any scenario out there right now where costs haven't gone up for just the same basic level of service. I mean, Starbucks, I'm getting the same quality coffee from Starbucks, I remember being like upset that my coffee was $4 and now it's $7. And that's, we're not insulated from that reality in the cost of delivering services. And we did insulate it for a while, and that's how we got here. And
I was going to address that a little bit with just the staffing level that we've tried to maintain over the last couple of years. We're at a point where we know that to maintain those permit timelines that we've been getting to is that staffing level we have currently. And with the budget shortfall, the increased budget would be the only way to keep that level of service. As we know, if we didn't have that budget come in, then we would then be looking at the decrease in staff level.
And if I can add to that too, I would say, you know, you were talking about kind of the same level of service. The planners we have right now are experienced. They've been here a while now. They know how to do their job well. And because we're not losing people every year, this is kind of the cost of doing that service well. So right. I think it is an increase in service because we have trained staff who can manage permits in a timely way. So
attention. So you want to take a schedule a public hearing. I'm trying to see if we can get out of here in 2 minutes. You want to schedule a public hearing, and is it the intent, Jonathan, in the public hearing to bring up all four of these options, or are you trying to get a sense from us which one option would we like to talk about in a public hearing?
Yeah, so like direction from the board on which option you'd like. We can then, like we did with the 2024 fee update, we would draft that resolution to show the proposed increases in a certain time amount. So if it was the 40% to be increased January 1st, 2026, then a 20% increase January 1st, 2027. And then in that resolution would address that meeting the CPI annually after that.
So commissioners of these four, where are you leaning, Joe?
Two.
Janet, to bring back two to the public hearing.
My one thing that we haven't talked about is timing. So you said January 1st. So we've got to have enough time to like advertise and promote the fact that the fees are going to change. So that means that a lot of people will come in December because they're going to want to beat the fee increases. Mm-hmm. But remember that we are closed to the public that week between Christmas and New Year's. Those 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I don't know timing wise if you want a January ish rollout,
or like that, February or something.
February 1st rollout or January 15th rollout, or I mean, the amount's nominal, but I want to just think through the reality of communication and then the impact on the work experience and then
even with the closure of the counters, our staff will still be processing permits, and folks can still do those permits online through our public portal. So, but that is a good point. So
we just said January 15th.
Does that mess up
your budgeting? Because, and then it's the same thing in 2027. It allows folks to come into the new year if they wanted to come to the counter and they got freaked out. It just gives us a grace period for our consumers.
Also, more importantly for me, when would this public hearing be, Layla?
2028.
I mean, this public hearing is probably not going to be till what?
I believe January has it on the calendar.
Okay.
Let me.
October 3rd
or something.
It just doesn't give people who are builders a whole lot of time to try to get their stuff in.
I would just caution the more that we go into the year, like last time when we did it, it wasn't until March 1st. So we actually didn't, we had like almost a full quarter of not seeing that price increase.
Right.
And so we didn't really get a feel for what it was going to do for our budget. So just acknowledge that the longer we go on through the year, then the more that red number might go up. Obviously with the permit tech position that we were not counting on, if I estimated that at $80,000, then we do have some wiggle room that we weren't accounting for.
Okay.
But we are.
Current date that's held for that hearing is November 10th.
See, that doesn't give the builders a lot of time.
What I don't want to have happen is also, I know you're saying that we're still working, which is exactly right. I mean, we're still doing the work. But what I don't want someone to do is to get the perception that we raised the fees on the 1st of January and then we closed their access down. And so we're just trying to stick it to them.
And we only give them a month. No.
Right. And so maybe if we could just like January 15th, that gives them 2 weeks into the year to figure out, like, we told you this was coming, we'll start advertising right away. But that at least softens that a little bit so that we're not...
You'll put
having irate thing, I've got a town hall around the holidays up. Yelling at us.
That's a good idea.
And when I say us, I mean you. Because I'll just say call Jonathan.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, option two.
Option two.
All right.
one thing to address kind of those comps. My thought is that in the next year, we've always been looking at the PA schedule up increases as just a percentage increase. We haven't gone in and gone line by line and looked at that, the staff time. So I could talk with you each about that, about in 2026, when we're preparing for the 2027 update of the fees, maybe going in and doing a more cleanup of the fee schedule and those line items, making sure we're in the right place for certain things.
Oh, good.
I like that. That's fine. It's the builders are in this conversation, whether they're in the room or not. They know, they've given us feedback. Where I think we'll have some pushback is the homeowner that isn't part of this conversation on a regular basis, and they don't understand, and how did this happen, and it'll blow up, and we just need to stay off social media for 6 months.
I've been given compliments on your building meetings that you restarted back up, and the excitement about the fact that those were continuing, and I said, well, I'm sure they are continuing since you're excited about them. So anyway, thank you for starting those back.
No problem.
So we won't have to come back here to continue this work session. We will reconvene for an executive session at 3 p.m. as allowed under RCW 42-31-10-1G to discuss the performance of a public employee. The executive session will occur in Administration Building Human Resources Room 200. It's expected to last 60 minutes until 4 p.m. with no announcement anticipated. No further business. The meeting is recessed until 3 p.m. for executive session. Thank you.
Emily,
your staff will present.
Good. You talked to Jonathan about the town hall and the you want.
It is 3 p.m. The board has resumed work session and gone directly into executive session as allowed under RCW 42.30.1101G to discuss the performance of a public employee. The executive session will occur in the Human Resources Room in the Administration Building, room number 200, and is expected to last until 4 p.m. with no announcement anticipated.
It is now 4 p.m. The board has stepped out of executive session and requested 15 more minutes to end at 4:15. It is 4:15 p.m. and the board has exited executive session and the meeting is adjourned.